Hello, and welcome to episode 214 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the place where the small press makes one hell of a big noise. I'm Vince Hunt, creator of The Red Mouse from Mars, and joining me this week, the creator of Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
The writer, I love your hello every week. It's so good. That was almost like a play school kind of, like a children's TV presenter.
Yeah, I'd watch Jack and Ori if you were reading shit out,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. and that was the
autobiography of Danny Dyer.
We might talk about that a bit later. Well, the writer behind Cockney Kung Fu, Tony Esmond.
Hello.
And this week, we're very pleased to be joined by a brilliant artist who we're huge supporters of and whose work can be seen in such titles as The Cthulhiad, The King's Leap, and the upcoming Space Warp. I got that right? Is it Space Warp?
That's the anthology, yeah.
Yes. And that was the voice of Gareth Slightholme. Hello, sir.
Hey, hello, Gareth Slightholme.
Welcome.
That was a smooth intro, wasn't it?
This has been a long time coming, having Gareth.
Yeah. 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 I mean, we talk about you enough, Gareth, and that's just off air.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did we interview you at Nottingham? I can't remember, Gareth. We did, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, that was good. Yeah. That was fun. Yeah.
And when last time we asked you, you said, sorry, I'm going on the BBC, fuck you. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
It was clearly something like that, yeah. I'm noted for my tact, obviously.
So. Yeah, because for those who don't know Gareth's a brilliant artist, but and he's just could be busier and busier over the next couple of years, so be prepared to hear and see.
He's a breakout artist.
Yeah, you're a breakout, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, put in the song Breakout at that point, shouldn't I? Well, I would if A, we could afford it, and B, I could be bothered.
The editor could just have a breakdown.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'd be an overnight success, even though you've been doing it for 15 years.
Yeah. Oh,
every
yeah.
night and day.
Those classic.
Do you remember they used to do Young Guns, and they'd all be in their 30s, these blokes? And I'm thinking, well, they are these Young Guns.
Yeah. Are you talking about the film? Anyway. Right.
It's a great film.
It's a great film.
Blue Diamond Phillips.
Yeah. Charlie Sheen gets taken out about third of the way through. Who saw that coming?
You're Lou Diamond Phillips, isn't it?
Spoilers for Young Guns.
I'm not being funny.
What's
Lou
that?
Diamond Phillips, a Native American. I'm not being funny, but he's not, is he?
No. I wouldn't like to comment, knowing our audience.
Times.
Yeah.
Different times.
Yeah. Different times.
But as Gareth is the number one expert in Lou Diamond Phillips, that's exactly why we brought him on the show this week.
Yeah. Doesn't do much these days, Lou Diamond Phillips, does he?
No.
There's some TV show with him in.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it was. It's one of those things that you see passing and you just think, that's not for me.
CSI Bognor or something like that.
CSI Bognor. I'd probably watch that.
Yeah.
Someone's had it away with a deck chair.
Yeah. You've got to take the sunglasses off even though there's absolutely no sun.
Who's done this seagull up the wrong end?
And then it goes, wow! Bow, bow, bow. We need to copyright this now. Now.
It's lovely to have you on, Gareth.
Yes. It is lovely. And recently, you've been on the airwaves, like on the BBC, haven't you? Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
It's local BBC radio, so we were just on there because the whole Comic Con was happening, and I got asked on there to chat about helping promote the event before it happened. And I think somebody must have heard that show, because I was basically on to talk about being a local comic artist. And then there was a couple of other people, one of the organisers from the show and somebody else that was involved in some of the cosplay and organising the show as well. And then one of the local sort of like guys who does the culture show on radio basically must have heard it and then just asked me on the show to just directly talk about comics. And it's great because he's a comic reader. And
yeah, he was nice. He was a big fan.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
So that made that a lot easier, really, just kind of chatting to people that kind of knew what they were talking about. And he was a huge fan of 2000 AD and Pat and stuff like that as well. And he wanted to just find out a little bit more about that. So that was great. And hopefully we're going to be on again with some more of the artists involved in Space Warp talking about that as well a little bit further down the line.
Nice, so, man. Oh, good. I'm glad. Yeah.
As it turns out, two of the other artists are very local to us as well. We've got a guy just across the water in Grimsby, and there's another one of the artists in Hull, and it's not by design. It's just how it's kind of...
Yeah, how weird is that? Because Ian Ashcroft is now up that way, isn't he?
Yeah. It's so odd that, when I was kind of like trying to figure out where everybody was, it was just like, oh my God, they're all on my doorstep. And it's one of those things, I think we were saying about it earlier, about this idea of society as an artist or a writer or somebody just involved in comics is really important. but you don't often know who's actually in the city or, you know, just...
Yeah, you know, I used to know. Because the only place you'd see anyone was picking up your weekly batch of comics, wasn't it? You know, there was no internet or anything like that. Yeah. You didn't know who was who or where was where, you know?
Yeah. And even then, you could be stood in the comic shop buying comics and chatting about comics and not know that they're actually working on their own book because not everybody sort of, like, you know, rams it down everyone's throats and that. It's just like, it's the thing that you do. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. When you went to UCAC and stuff like that, I didn't know what anyone looked like.
No.
You sort of listen out for an American accent and try and figure out who someone was where you were having a conversation. And that was about it, you know.
And look at us now.
Yeah. Now we can't get them off the internet, can we?
Fucking empire.
Yeah. Well, we've been infecting the internet for the past few years. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. But do you know what is infectious, though, Tony?
STDs.
And reading comics on Comic House.
Yes. Those two are not. There's no correlation between those two.
Yes.
No.
To point that out before we go any further.
One of them you should see a doctor about, and the other one is only £3 a month subscription. And
that's the smoothest you've ever been.
And I'm going to keep going and ignore him. Because Comic House is the indie comic marketplace with a difference, and they sponsor this little show. And yeah, they're great guys anyway. We love them, and they put up with these ads. But there's a huge selection of titles on their database. On the website itself, there's loads of... hard copies of indie books from UK and beyond. I think there's a few American sort of printed books as well.
Dynamite and all blah blah blah.
So it's not just UK exclusive. But what they also have as well, they have an app which we push every week, and we also read a lot, and it's brilliant. And it's a new way to sort of get hold of like indie UK and worldwide comics at your beck and call. And what sort of stuff have they got there at the moment, Dan?
Featured new additions this week include Away, Zero Jumper, Madison Dark, and Jamshide 1 from the mighty Marcosio Enterprises. There's tons of Marcosio stuff being added over the next few months.
More about them later.
Excellent. We've also got Soulbound issue 1 from Other Realm Studio, Another Dimension from Unlikely Story Productions, The Hammer issue 1 from Iceberg Productions, and Surrealsville issue 14.
14, bloody hell.
Nice. That's
Intruder.
I mean, let's face it, and let's just put it on the line, not everyone can be as productive and get to the sort of numbers that Dan Butcher can when it comes to an individual comic series.
No, thank you.
Some dream of it being Dan.
Yeah, I do.
And then you wake up in a sweat, in a ditch, thinking, covered in someone else's fluids. And you think,
and my own, don't be like that. Some of my own.
Well, you know.
Jesus.
And you scream to the moonlit sky, Butcher! And then you use your Comic House subscription to check out Vanguard, which is also
that's what I always do when I'm lying in a ditch.
The only thing to hand is your tablet. You can look at that.
Yeah.
Don't ring the police or ambulance or anything. Just...
No. Yeah. It'll protect your modesty.
Your Comic House. Priorities, my friend.
Yeah.
Yes.
Jesus Christ, is issue 16 of Vanguard's just been updated.
Oh, my God. I'm not going to call the ambulance for a while. I'm going to read that first. That's how
I... But I was going to say, you should check out Way, definitely. John Leight and Grant Richards.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. That's a bestial book, isn't it? I love that book.
Yeah.
Robin Jones does the lettering, I think. I think there's something involved, but I can't remember who it is. So apologies, that person.
I mean, there's a lot of books on the Comic House sort of app and their service that we've talked about on the show. Lots of recommendations that we recommended that have now, like Away, have recently appeared on the app. So you definitely need to check it out. If you want to find out more about it, it's like Netflix, basically. The streaming service, I should call it a streaming service instead of Netflix. They don't need the money, do they?
Yeah, Netflix pisses me off now. There's not that much on there I want to watch. I only really got it to watch the Marvel shows, and they've all gone now.
Yeah, we're going to drop it for a few months and then pick it back up in a little while. Because we just go on it and say, oh, we've seen that.
Yeah, I'm like that at the moment. Mm. I don't mind Prime because there's loads of really shit kung fu and horror movies on there.
It fucks me up. I've complete complained about Prime, but like, I sort of like just click on the film, see what that's like. And then suddenly there's like a load of Steven Seagal and Van Damme. And I'm like, well, where are these hiding?
Yeah, but
It seems like you kind of got to know a secret code to get to the good shit.
Yeah, on there. Yeah.
It's the people also watched section, isn't it?
Yeah.
Got to check.
God.
They're my kind of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All depends on your browser history.
I've been watching Humanoids from the Deep this week. That's good.
Oh, Jesus Christ. That's a bit dark in places, isn't it?
For comedy results on my wife's one, I put Nymphoid, Barbarian, and Dinosaur Hell on
classic
the watch list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. It's a shame it's a trauma one. I wanted it to be like a proper horrible kind of thing.
Troma movies are, I love the titles, but they're pretty much unwatchable, aren't they?
Yeah, they're not very good.
No.
Yeah.
And anyone that's listened to this show for an extended period of time knows that if Tony says that film is unwatchable, oh my lord, it must
Sergeant
be.
Sergeant Boogeyman's all right, but after that, you know.
Yeah. Anyway, so Comic House is like that, really. So yeah, go to comichouse.com and find out more.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's our best advert for ages, that one.
Yeah, I think it is. But then
we say that every week.
We say that, yeah, we do say that every week. We're so surprised.
Saying I was in a ditch covered in spunk, that is by far the best.
I didn't say it was that. I just said fluids. Did I say bodily fluids?
There was a seagull assault earlier in the program as well. That's what I'm thinking the title of this show is, just in my own head.
Yeah, I've been seagulled. I've been seagulled.
Don't encourage him.
You've got to go off a balcony, haven't you, I suppose? Or got a truck or something.
What was it, that thing I sent you? I went away for the week and there was like a questionnaire for like, what does this marine animal call their, where they lay their eggs? And I think it was like a fisherman's wallet. No, to sort of like, there was families going past that said to stop and take a picture of that for you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I've also done is I've just made a timestamp of when this episode went completely tits up.
Hello Kitty, yeah. Dan's picture of Hello Kitty. My favourite picture ever.
Oh, yes. Dan with a Hello Kitty statue. Amazing. Yeah. But anyway, let's get stuck into this week's topic. Because we're doing something different for the next few weeks. I say different, it's still us, it's still talking comics, and as you can tell for the past 5 minutes it's been absolute nonsense. Yep. But this week it's part two of our series. I guess we can say we're calling it a series, aren't we? Because we literally are. This is the first time we've ever done a series as such, isn't it? It's almost like
we've done theme shows, but this is like focusing on creating comics.
Yes, yes.
It's like ongoing, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Leads into the next.
Yeah, so this week is part two of our series about the comic making process. Thank you for all the kind words on our last show, by the way. And any new listeners, hello. Welcome.
Yeah,
or welcome back. Or you're still listening. Brilliant. Yeah.
Sorry for all the spunk chat.
Oh.
Don't usually go off the rails a bit later in the show.
Yeah. In about 3 minutes, it'll probably get. There'll be genuine conversation.
It's because we know Gareth.
Yes. I mean,
if you think this is the bottom, fucking strap in.
Yeah. Wait till we get to an hour and 50. That's when it really gets bad.
Yeah. We'll just find another barrel. That's what we'll do.
Yeah.
We never stop at one. yes, but thank you very much for all the kind words on our last show where we talked about the writing process for comics with David Hine.
That was good
fun. Hope you got some tips or some insight into the comic making process. This line of shows, obviously we're taking it from the beginning until the end in a very loose sort of way. Yeah.
You don't have to do it that way.
No.
Yeah.
One of the things he brought up that Paps also brought up is the idea of you don't get paid to come up with the idea. Do you know, like the time to kind of think an idea up? I think
all the research.
See, like you've got David Hyde had like the sketchbooks and notebooks of ideas ready to kind of go with, and then if you get approached by it, you'd look through it and then maybe retool one to kind of use. And it's like, well, that coming up with that idea wasn't paid for. Do you know, he had to come up with that on his own time.
Today I was asked to do an anthology with quite a short deadline, and that's where I went to some notes I'd made from previously.
That's why the notebooks are always handy, people. Definitely sort of keep them around, even if it's just your phone. Doesn't really matter, you can just put notes anyway. So obviously stage one was the writing process, and now we move on to the next stage of comics. You've written your script and now it's time for the next stage of bringing it to life and the artwork in stage. So I don't know, maybe you've written it for yourself. I don't know, we don't know. Maybe you've written a script for someone else, or maybe you're just an artist who wants to create some badass work from someone else's writing. You just want to make comics.
We can talk about it all, can't we?
Whatever it is, over the next like hour or so, we're just going to be talking about the whole comic artworking process. As always, this is just, you know, it's our theory. There's no fixed way of doing things. You might get some tips, you might get some hints, you might agree or disagree or you know, with whatever we say. But who knows where this is going to go.
I've got a proposition we can start off on.
The
initial, you've got a script and contacting the artist and discussing how you're going to get about paying for the work or getting the work from them. what kind of process works for us, you, Gareth, and any tips on how to proceed with that?
Yeah, I think that's good, because Gareth, you've worked with, like, and you're continuing to work with quite a few artists, aren't you? Did you start with your own comics before moving on to someone else?
Yeah, I was, I kind of dabbled, I suppose. I used to knock about with, I worked at an archaeology unit years and years ago, and I was an illustrator. Oh, wow. I was a trainee illustrator. That was back in my late teens. And the boss of the studio, the art boss of the studio, was making his own comics. And that was back in the day where he had a subscription list and sent his comics out to people that basically had subscribed via the post through the back of a, you know, obviously a list in the back of a magazine somewhere else. So
that's cool.
It's the really early days of that kind of independent comic book making, and that in the UK, I suppose. And he'd done, he was working on a comic of Beowulf at the time, and some other stuff that he'd done, some comedy sort of like historical stuff and everything like that. So I was kind of introduced to that idea of independent comic book making there. But one of the other guys that joined me at the archaeology unit working there, Dave Chapman, he was working on his own comics as well, and just basically, you know, photocopying them A4 and selling them and stuff like that to people that he knew. And that was great to see as well. He ended up, he did some work with Disraeli a little bit later on down the line.
Oh, well, okay.
That was kind of my first intro, and they introduced me to the whole kind of new wave of stuff that had been coming out, obviously, so Dark Knight and all of that lot. And I guess that was my intro to sort of like, you know, independent comic book making and stuff like that. But then, more recently, I suppose it was we'd gone to Thought Bubble, me and my missus and a friend, and we stood around and she was saying, you know, how come you guys aren't doing this? And it's because I don't have a comic. And that was basically the answer. And then before I'd known anything, you know, how it all worked out, I booked a table, and I still didn't have a comic, but I had a year to make one, and I was working
as
a teacher in an art school. So that kind of forced a deadline. And then I made The Indian Fighter, which was like a kind of like a horror western, and did it in a square format book, really kind of just drew everything in my sketchbook, didn't really know what I was doing, even though I'd done like little bits and pieces before. I was kind of almost like reinventing the wheel for myself, which was an idiotic thing to do, because I knew some of the rules and just seemed to break them for no reason. And and then before you know it, you're sitting at a table with a, you know, a load of books that you've printed, and people are coming up and showing an interest in, which is great. But that was kind of my approach, I suppose.
So you sort of kind of forced your own hand, didn't you?
Having a deadline is brilliant. Yeah. So and I think a lot of people say that, you know, people say give yourself a deadline if you want to produce, because if you want to get better at anything, you've just got to do a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And to do a lot of work, you kind of need somebody to be able to show that to. Or, I mean, I guess it's why colleges and things like that work in the way that they do, in that they force people's hand to have a deadline, even if it's an artificial one. But giving yourself a real deadline when you've got like a show that you want to get stuff ready for, that's a little bit more, you know.
Yeah.
It really kind of drives you to do it. So.
It's also the kind of managing your deadlines and managing your work. And for instance, say I've got 30 days to get this work done. Budget in time to kind of do this, as opposed to thinking, oh, we'll get it done. And then usually it's that wanky saying, but if you fail to prepare, you're prepared to fail.
Yeah.
You really need to kind of put the groundwork in.
I mean, I think there is that kind of planning process. I think when I was doing the Cthulhu stuff on my own, what I would do is I would write a lot of it in my phone. So I would do the scripting on my phone, just in Color Note or something like that. And then slowly start to sort it out into a Word file, and then at the point where I felt I had stuff that I really wanted to draw, I would start sketching it up and just doing random sketches from throughout the book, things that I was really keen on, sort of like working on. And then during that summer break that I had as a lecturer, which, you know, amounted to a couple of weeks or so in the middle of sort of like August, I would try and batter it all out then. And then get everything prepared. Then it'd be a case of sort of like working on getting stuff ready for the printer and sort of like sorting all that side of it out, ready for Thought Bubble, which was obviously in the November. And then there was that lovely year when they moved everything forward. And I suddenly lost a few weeks and everything off that. But that was great, because it just kind of pressured you into doing stuff. And, you know.
Yeah, you're forced into a learning curve, aren't you?
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, I think the year I did Dracon was mental, because I basically realised that the deadline for getting the work to the printer with a week to spare that they could print the book before I actually went to Thought Bubble at that weekend, I had 4 weeks and I had nothing apart from a load of script stuff. And I just sat down and I thought, right, what's the simplest method I can use to sort it? So I just got a brush pen out and I worked at A4 and I produced the 48-page book in 4 weeks, which is nuts. So, but I don't think I'm going to do that again because I was just literally mental by the end of it.
We've definitely learned from it. I mean, and since then,
absolutely, yeah.
And once you started, dude, you've been massively prolific, and not just in sort of comics as well, because you're always posting concept work, and you've got lots of projects on the go and stuff. Mm. So, you know, and I think it's great that you started like just busting out your own stuff, and then eventually people. What was it like the first time someone came to you with a script? Someone else.
That was Rob, I think. Basically, Rob Jones. It seems
was
to
that, the, was that the King's Leap? Or was that?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Basically, Rob came to me and sort of like said, I've seen some of your Viking drawings online. Do you want to make a Viking book? It was pretty much that direct. And contacted me via the internet messenger. And so we said, yeah, that's great. Sounds like a great idea. We'll collaborate on that. And so we just kind of did it. And he sent me some script ideas and stuff. We toed and froed with kind of stuff that I wanted to draw and that he wanted to write. I think he wanted to do something that had a little... was I don't know, maybe a little darker or a little more serious in turn than some of his other stuff that he'd done, and so we kind of toed and froed with that. We toed and froed the scripts a little bit, and then I just laid in and started to do the drawings and stuff like that. And then the first time we actually met each other, we tried to meet each other beforehand and tried to arrange it, but the first time we actually met each other was when we planted the books on the tables at Thought Bubble.
Oh, I was there that year.
Okay.
Yeah.
which is again a bit mad, but it was great. So you know, we just did that.
Nice. Well. That's the modern world, isn't it, though, Gareth? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we shared the print costs on that one, so you know we got some done here and some done there, and we just kind of brought the books to the table, and it was good. And so we continued to do that, and I've got the pencils all done, and so much of the ink's done for the third book in the Viking series now. So,
right. Oh, nice.
So much.
You're a busy man, dude.
Yeah, busy man.
You wouldn't think of it looking at me most of the time. It seems like I'm just kind of like standing in front of my drawing board wondering what I'm doing.
No, because normally when we see a picture of you, you're stood in front of your banner at some sort of event. You are always on the go, so don't give us that, son. But what was seeing Rob's script then was, because obviously I guess you wrote for yourself.
Which is just chaos most of the time. It's like
I'm guessing that a lot of artists out there, they don't necessarily write a full script for themselves because they know exactly what they're going to do. This is, you know...
I think you juggle a lot of it in your head when you're working on your own stuff.
I mean, Dan, what do you write? Do you write full... You don't write full script for yourself, do you?
No, I usually have, like, a rough outline and what people are going to say, and I kind of know where I'm going to go from there. I don't need to write out the entire... Like, because you write for yourself, you don't need to give instructions to someone else who's going to interpret it later.
Yeah. I will say... I think maybe if you're an artist who's writing for yourself, and yes, you're gonna draw it, but you want people to look over the script and do some edits or something like that. I think it's beneficial to put some descriptive stuff in there so they know what they're reading. I mean, I certainly recently, for something that the Awesome Pod are doing, you know, I've written my first draft of a script and I sent it to Dan and Tony, and I put the description so you guys knew what you could see it in your mind, wouldn't it? And I mean, if I was doing shorthand, you probably wouldn't have had a grasp of what it was, would it? So yeah.
It depends. It really depends who you're writing for as well, doesn't it? I just wrote something for Nick again, and there's a shorthand that he and I have got. Yeah. You know. So
which wasn't in the first script, but now.
Yeah, it isn't. Yes. But he knows what I'm talking about when I say go a bit mad magazine on this page. I mean, he knows
with,
what I mean.
That comes with trust as well, though, doesn't it?
Yeah,
well?
Yeah, exactly.
So once you've got that bond of trust and you kind of know where everybody's at, and if you've sat in a pub and sort of like thrashed ideas out just in the air, you can say, you know, that fight scene that we talked about in the pub or whatever, and it's, you know, it's almost like there.
Yeah, yeah.
Got us to say, I'm not mad about as an artist. This may come differently for different artists or writers. It's when I give them the script and I'm told every single page how every panel size should be. I'm not mad on that.
This ties into what I was about to ask as well, because obviously, from an artist's perspective, we like to be. Oh well, everyone's got their own way of working, of course, but we like to know where we're going with it. Obviously, reference we talked about reference on the previous show from writers and stuff. That always helps if a writer has a view, because you don't want to go backwards and forwards all the time.
Yeah,
do you?
Definitely.
You know, you don't want to. I mean, I've heard stories from like some writers or, you know, some collaborations where a writer's had a view, they've sent it to an artist, and it's come back, and the person will look different, or the building will look different, or you know, you need to put the communication in of, if you wanted it to look a certain way, the artist wants to know.
Yeah.
Every time. And mostly, I mean, I've seen lots of scripts that have just got, you know, they've got quick links, haven't they? You know, it's easy enough to do.
I think they're great. Yeah. Cause,
yeah. But in terms of like artwork, how do you feel when a writer just sort of says, here's a splash page, one line of text of what's going to happen, just go for your life? They don't give you any strict sort of direction.
It's a tough call, isn't it? Because I think a lot of people, and you guys work in design as well, don't you? Away from comics as well. So it's that whole idea of having boundaries. Some people think boundaries are really restrictive, but what they actually do is just free up that creative process or concentrate it, because you can eliminate a lot of stuff straight off the bat and kind of go for it. So having that kind of free rein sometimes is great if you're that way inclined and that day. But, you know, if also, you know, you're kind of worried about other, or thinking about other jobs, having that kind of free rein, it just makes it so difficult. And you end up having to do like more thumbnails than you would have. Yeah. And I think that's the thing, is that in that situation, I would probably send several thumbnails to somebody and say, which of these is kind of like the way to go, do you think?
One of the things I always kind of, as I've grown as a designer, is if I've got a brief which is all over the place, the first thing I do is go and get like a more refined brief. Same with the comic stuff, because if they say, oh yeah, not too fast, do it like this, invariably whatever you give them, we go, oh, I don't like that. It's not what I wanted. Is that what you didn't tell me what you wanted? So that initial process has been completely wasted, because we didn't understand what we were doing with each other.
It's the quote from the worst art directors of all time, isn't it? I don't know what I want, but I'll know it when I see it.
Yeah, terrible.
Like, wow. I mean, I tend to be quite detailed with my stuff, but also with the caveat that if you want to change it around a bit, do what you like. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So sometimes I do describe like panel. I wrote something today, like a small indent panel of a phone ringing. Can you make it an old style phone? And it'd be nice if it was a circular panel with the ring shooting out of it. But I know if you don't want to do that, you don't want to do that. So I'm fine with that. You know, I trust him enough to.
I think it's more like of kind of I don't know, over descriptive panels, when it's like a tiny panel, and then it's like Joe Bloggs is in front of like a massive arcane library with thousands of tomes on the wall. So how the fuck am I going to do that?
I think some of the stuff as well is around facial acting. So you might say such and such is standing there. He's standing at the other man. He's looking really confused, but with a hint of humor about it. And you think, how the fuck am I going to draw that?
Yeah, right, because the comic book panel is a snapshot. It's not 5 seconds of footage, so you can't have a face changing from happiness to surprise in one hit. You have to. That becomes probably two panels. Do you know what I mean?
Look sad, look confused, but don't be. You know, he's moving from happiness into anger.
Yeah.
You know,
you can't have six things happening in this one panel. You know, unless they're individually happening in the background simultaneously. Yeah. But you know, it's six actions. It's probably six panels. Yeah.
What do you think is good advice for writers in terms of when they're sending a script to an artist? What sort of things do you like to see in a script that help you?
I think it's different from each person that you've kind of worked with. I mean, sometimes I think, it depends on the type of work you're doing. If it's work for hire work, you kind of just got to knuckle down and do what's there in front of you.
Yeah.
You don't have necessarily any leeway to change anything. You can bring your own style and sort of like style of working and your own kind of camera viewpoints to certain panels and stuff like that. Mm. But you've eventually got to just kind of do what's there in the script. Whereas if it's more of a collaboration, you do have that to and fro, so it can be a little bit looser. So I think what's been really exciting for me recently is working with people who kind of, as writers, really know what they're doing. Because as a writer, I don't think I do that. And an editor would have been a wonderful thing to have worked with, I suppose, when I was working on the early Cthulhiad stuff. But it's been great to work with writers who've got a little bit more experience and, you know, when you look at what they're doing as an artist who's kind of like really just kind of trying to still find his way in comics, you'll sometimes look at something and you go, oh, why has that happened? And then when you start to thumbnail it out, you go, oh, God, yeah, no, that makes perfect sense that this works this way. And it's been really kind of interesting to work with people that have that experience. And I think if you're an artist working in comics in the indie scene, you're going to end up with writers who have not a great deal of experience.
Yeah.
Some artists who have no experience but have really good stuff that you want to work on.
Yeah.
And writers who also have loads and loads of experience, and I think at that point you kind of sit back and you just want to learn.
Yeah, and I think it's beneficial for writers and artists in terms of the collaboration. If you're a writer writing for someone else, you may see an artist who's super detailed. You know, I mean, as Dan would say, you know, there's two, I don't know, arcane wizards, and you've got five pages in a huge library. You know, the detail. I mean, Gareth would love it because there's detail everywhere. Yeah. But you know, you don't want to sort of give an artist that and then have it's basically five pages of speech bubbles covering everything. I think you need to put it, you know, if you've got a slice of life, people talking in a coffee shop, you need to think about the sort of artist you're going for as well, and that sort of the style. You have to be quite clear with what you want, really.
I suppose it's also knowing what the artist does as well. I mean, if you're an artist who works with an inch wide brush on all of their comic art and everything like that, you don't want to say that there are 12 panels on this page and each one of them shows a 100 different books in the background of this one. Yeah. Because they ain't going to do it with that inch brush, are they? It's just not going to happen. You need to play to the artist's strengths or whatever. It's been nice as well, again, working with... It's always great when a writer knows your stuff and basically says, you know, I've seen that you do this kind of stuff, and I kind of wrote this in because I know you enjoy this kind of stuff as well.
Yeah,
you know, so that's good. And I think there's the freedom to do that in the indie scene as well, which is great. So,
one of the things I might mention is when a lot of artists are kind of starting out, they might get asked to work for free or exposure on stuff or collaborate on a project, and I don't necessarily have a strong opinion on doing it or not, as long as you're not being taken advantage of. But I feel like a lot of artists do get that kind of. That maybe the first start doing collaborations. Is that something you've done, Gareth, or would you recommend that to artists?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends. I mean, because, you know, there's free and free, isn't there? There's free where you do stuff and you have absolutely no recompense at all. And that's the kind of awful exposure thing, isn't it?
Yeah. You know
what I mean? But there's also where you do it together and collaborate, and then you both get to sell the book in equal amounts or something like that at the end.
Yeah.
But there's also... You could work with somebody, and this is not something necessarily I've not in the comics field, but certainly in another area where I've gone, I'm going to take a much lower kind of like rate on this because the project itself is really worthwhile and it's great. And it's definitely it's not going to be this kind of like nonsensical exposure. This is going to be real exposure on a great project that I'll be proud to show people. That's money in the bank for further down the line.
I mean, we've seen a kickoff around this over recent years, haven't we, about people going on about exposure. And like I did when I started off in the small press, I did it with a mate because we wanted to make comics.
Yeah.
And that's why I did it. And you don't have to get paid for everything you do. People don't realise that.
No,
there's a lot of charity projects out there, for example, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, charity projects are charity projects, aren't they? And that's the thing. But I think what you know inside if you're getting done over.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
You know what I mean?
Being taken advantage of.
If you're being taken advantage of and you know it, don't do it.
Yeah.
That would be my advice to any artist out there. If you think you're getting done over, and somebody's giving you the big spiel about the fact that, you know, that they know what they're doing and everything, and you should be doing this for, you know, for free because you're going to get loads of exposure, at that point you walk away.
Oh, one of the big red flags for me is when someone says, I've not written comics before or done this before, we're hoping to get this picked up by Image or Dark Horse. It's like, stop immediately because if you've not even made one comic book and you've got those dreams, you just don't understand.
You're just not cut out for it.
I think for that first thing, if you're really going to kind of take it anywhere, either you do it all yourself and you use disposable income to do it, you know, and take it to your first show. But also, if you want to take it to a first show and you don't feel like you're a competent writer to write your own comics as an artist or vice versa, find somebody you trust, you know, and work with them. And you must have, if you're an artist, the likelihood is you're going to have a writer in your social circle somewhere along the line.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's a mate of mine introduced me to mate, and then we started making comics. And that's
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a better way of meeting a creator as opposed to applying to a random message.
And I think probably the most important word that we've ever used on this podcast, and we will continue to use it, is communication. Now, you know, how many tales have we heard from, you know, across the board, every single one of us, about, you know, things are going, it's all good to begin with, and then it goes quiet, and then you're having real problems getting in touch with someone.
When the quiet, when you've been like answering every
sorry,
email.
Vince.
No, we're good, dude. We're good.
When you've been answering every email, every sort of like tweet, whatever, and then suddenly you go dark, it's just alarm bells immediately. So you think, what the fuck's happening?
Especially if you've got a project which has like a super strict deadline. You know, if you've got a, if you've got a fluid project that's like, look, this will be when it's ready and when it's awesome is when it will be released. It, you know, if it's like, if you've got that sort of thing, that's fine. You know, but
I think
but if
communication
you're,
goes along with being professional. That's
exactly
it's being professional,
especially with the work for hire thing, isn't it? It's like, we've got this project. We want you to work on it. This is when it's going to release. There has to be, you know, if you've got those strict sort of schedules, you know, if you've got some sort of thing like that, you have to be in constant communication, you know, as an artist or as a writer, you know, and it works across the board. Everyone has to talk to each other, you know, and even if it's just, you know, that's not sort of like you have to email your writer every day or every 30 seconds or every time you sketch something. You could have, you know, you could have a shit week, you know, if you're not, every single one of us, I don't do it full time. You know, it's, you know, you have to do it when you can do it. And, you know, I've had bad weeks where I get nothing done in the week. And I'm, you know, I do kick myself about it sometimes, but that's life.
I had a technical issue recently with, I was using my computer in the heat. You know, we had that really hot Thursday.
Yeah.
And I think something happened in the machine, like some of the thermal paste fucked up and it basically won't stay on longer than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I got it fixed, but like for a week, I didn't have my computer.
Also, you need to do a comic called Hot Thursday.
But like that was Hot Thursday.
That's that Project Hoax comic. So I said, Sam, look, I can't do anything this week because the machine's out of action. And it was fine.
Yeah.
Because as long as you give them that heads
you're
up.
Well ahead on that, man.
Yeah, I'm well ahead. So that was a bit of a saving grace.
Yeah, but knowing you, Dan, you were bloody miles ahead in terms of like you're probably 5 years ahead. But you still kicked yourself, didn't you? Even though you had those, as soon as you had that problem, you kicked yourself. Go on, admit it.
Yeah, of course.
He's a pro.
I wonder
the views on X-Hamster went right down as well. I tell you that.
I blueballed myself on my computer
on Hot Thursday.
But I'd say also the flip side of the coin of not being paid for doing work, which we discussed, but the other side of taking on a project just for the money.
Yeah.
There's a kind of something got to be kind of a bit careful with there, because
especially if you've got other projects on as well at the same time.
Yeah,
it looks like it's a great gig, and you're thinking, I really want to do this, but you know, it's going to screw up all of the other projects.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's really problematic.
But say someone came to you and they said like they had a decent amount of money and they showed you the comic and it was just it wasn't very good, borderline poor. To the point where, like, no one's really going to like this, but the money. And then, like, would you go for that, like, take the money over the comic or vice versa?
I think I'm in a position where I'm thinking that I want the comics that I make to be well thought of. And so it sounds so awful. But that idea of trying to maintain a reputation a little bit,
of course,
while you're first starting out, and then obviously by the time you get past that, hopefully you won't have to think about those things anymore, because a lot of the projects that come forward are the ones that you have the time to do will be ones that you'll really enjoy, I guess. But I think it's not everybody's saying that has that luxury, I suppose. And I don't know, I mean, it's a case of balancing things out. I mean, this idea of sort of like, you know, what's levels of getting paid, you know, via if you're going to do something for little in the way of sort of like financial recompense, you want it to be an absolutely blinding project.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I suppose the inverse is true. If you're going to take money for something that's an awful project, it needs to be a real great big pile of money.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
That's taller than you are.
Scrooge McDuck.
I guess one of the things with comics, someone always say, oh yeah, the comic's not very good, but the art is fucking knockout.
Yeah.
I guess that's one of the things you've got going for it. Where, say, if you did a film, usually when something's bad, like the movie's got a shit script, you kind of, oh, it's fucking shit. And but the special effects are really nice.
I think something that comes back to something that Gareth said as well, with those projects, in terms of like work for hire, if you're quite passionate about it, work in that sort of, you know, I'd like some copies to sell at my table. You know, I think if it's just work for hire, if it's just money, if you don't need copies for your table, then, you know, put your page rate up or whatever. You know, but if it's something you're passionate about and you would like copies at your table, maybe that affects your page rate in some ways. Or maybe the writer sort of says, oh, I can give you this and 100 copies for you to sell and do what you want with them. Do you know what I mean? It's that sort of, you know, there's lots of different ways of working, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think it comes down to just that having your own, like I said before, you know when you're being done over. And if you're willing to accept being done over at this stage, do you know what I mean? Then you'll probably do it again. And this rule probably fits to all areas of life, not just making comics. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's the idea that if you're willing to accept it once, you're probably going to have it done to you again. So don't.
I just want to let Dan and Tony know that he has no idea that I've done him over yet. Life.
Yeah, we know.
we've talked in the past about contracts with artists. Yeah. And it's not something I do a lot with the people I work with, usually because I sort of know them and know they've got a bit of MO for sort of being okay. But I think even a kind of a relatively simple email at the start of a project saying, I want X amount of pages and they're going to be for this amount of money and it's going to be delivered at this time.
Yeah.
I think that's
There's got to be some sort of digital trail, hasn't there? There's got to be some sort
an expectation of what you're going to get from the artist.
I will give you this, and the other person says yes, and that's...
Yeah. And then we're never going to go.
There's always
going to
be psychos that just change their mind anyway. And it doesn't matter how thick the paper trail is. You know, I mean, there's always going to be, you know, these lunatic people that sort of like turn around and sort of like go, yeah, well, you know, I've decided I'm going to make the whole comic sort of like landscape rather than portrait now.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to pay for any of the art that we've done before, but I'm still willing to pay for the next bit of it. And you're like, you know,
is this happened?
They fuck it up, has this happened,
Gareth?
Not in comics, no. In other areas of my life, it certainly has.
But you always find the person who goes mental on social media about how badly they were treated. There's always that self-destructive person. And if you've got an email that you can like show and say, mate, this is what you agreed to, this is it in black and white, you know what I mean? I think that's always a good idea.
Yeah, I agree.
I've had some kind of like, you know, I suppose as work for hire, you know, contracts are what they are. They're basically, and they're usually provided by the person that contacts you. So you end up, you're working for them, and that's great.
Yep.
And if it's all clear in black and white and you've all signed it, you've done NDAs and everything else, great. But I've also worked with people, one of my favourite contracts I ever signed, it was mad. It was just like a single page. The guy was incredibly professional and had a real reputation, and basically said that if I pull out of this, not me, but if he pulled out of the project halfway through and half the work had been done, he'd pay me half the work and all. And it was just like really clear, and it was the friendliest contract I'd ever signed. It was just lovely. So it shows it can be done as well.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And my enthusiasm from the point of wanting to work on the project after seeing that contract, I threw myself into it. And so he probably got time and a half's worth of work on the project simply because I knew I was safe as an artist and I was committing to something where this person, it felt right.
There's a lot to be said for that, isn't there? You know, you know, art really is something that is about inspiration, how you feel in the moment. We read monthly comics and you can tell when someone phones it in.
Or
if a deadline, you know, is looming so quickly that they haven't been able to put the effort that they'd like into it, so therefore they've just, you know, essentially photocopied it or something like that. Whereas that's why I think a lot of these, you know, you see these creator-owned image books, or, you know, whether they be at Dark Horse or whatever it is, these creators that we know from like some of the big two, they go away, they work on 6 issues for, you know, they disappear for like 8-9 months, and then when you see 6 issues, it's like, my God. You know, look at the detail. Look at that. Look at how much effort was put into these pages. And it's like you see a different artist sometimes.
it's the real ownership of the work, and yeah. And I think again, through. When it comes to collaborations as well, you know, that having, whether it's the writer or the artist, if you're an artist who's hired a writer, or if you're a writer who's hired an artist, you want that kind of commitment to your project to make it really worth its weight in gold. And it involves everything then, because it's really about the kind of trust between the partners involved in the project, but also about this idea of not wanting to put somebody off or make them feel like they're on the back foot from the contract out. You know what I mean? Because we've all seen these kind of like hard-ass contracts and everything like that, where you feel like you're going to get a bailiff turn up at your door if you don't actually respond to the email that the contract was on. And it's like, what is this about? I'm supposed to be enjoying this as a project as well as, you know, earning a little bit of money. But
I was going to say, payment-wise, are you, what kind of financial thing you talk about? Like, would you get like paid for the entire project up front, or half and half, or page by page upon delivery? What's the usual kind of way you work?
I've had all of it. I've had where somebody's stipulated the finished book will result in this amount of money. Other people have suggested page rates. I've suggested page rates. You know, and then outside of comics, it goes into sort of like either hourly rates or day rates and stuff like that. And I think it's about finding what everybody feels more comfortable with, because sometimes the numbers, when they're really large, people freak out. And then sometimes when the numbers seem very, very small, but the pages stack up, that also can freak people out. So I think everybody's got to understand what the payment's about. But I've had a varying different sort of like approaches, you know, and even, you know, there's the idea of spec work with the way that the money will come in after the fact and stuff like that. So,
yeah,
I mean, I don't know about you guys, just across the board, whether it be from writing something or drawing something, the idea of spec work, you do this and then you'll get a bit of money afterwards when it sells this many copies, or, you know, we get that movie deal or something like that. I think in this day and age, that you've got to be skeptical.
It depends what it is and who it's coming from, I think, sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. You know, I think that's this comes down to that trust and the relationships between people, or what the project is as well. Do you know what I mean? At the end of the day.
Consider it like gambling money. That money, as soon as you're gambling with that money, you can should consider it gone. So if you do that kind of spec work stuff,
don't but you, got, you you run the odds. You think, what's the likelihood of this coming in? And some's good, and some's like pretty much non-existent from some of the chances out there. But there's your people who, you know,
And that's the thing. If you know the name of the person, and the person has a track record of the books going out the door, and, you know, you can see that's happening, then there's the more likelihood that it's going to work for you as well. You know, there's always the likelihood that something disaster's going to happen, and loads of projects happen like that. I remember when, you know, 9/11 happened, and all of the kind of like the theme park work that I was working on at the time just seemed to dry up, and there was loads of stuff on the table, and it just all seemed to go away in the kind of the 8 months after it happened. So there's things that you can't predict. I mean, in comics, I think if you're working with somebody who is an unknown, who contacts you via email because they've seen something on your art station, or or a comic that you've like put out at a show, and they say, you know, that they're wanting to do this kind of spec work and everything, and you do a little bit of an internet research on them, and you find that they've not made anything else before, or you can't find anything else by them, it becomes harder to kind of like, not necessarily trust, but to make the argument for yourself that you're willing to commit to that.
Yeah, you got to be careful. There's a few rolling butters out there, aren't there? Let's face it. Yeah.
But I mean, this person might be completely genuine. And, you know, they might be, you know, the project might have turned out great, but you've just got to make that decision, because I'm getting a little bit long in the tooth, and sometimes I just have to make the decision based on how I feel about it.
Yeah, that's all you can do, man. That's all you can do. And it's an artistic thing, isn't it? If you get inspiration from what they're writing, they could be anyone.
Yeah.
Be your mum. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
I mean, you see writers come out of nowhere, don't you? I mean, sometimes and everything like that. They might have been working for years and stuff, and it might be their seventh album sort of thing, you know, in music parlance. But it's, there's been
great collaborations. I'm a little bit dubious of new writers. As more movies get made, we do get those people who just decide they're comic writers, don't we? I see it more and more these days, you know. And they ain't got a Scooby-Doo, you know.
Yeah. That one you said about the screenplay writing at the beginning of the comic.
Yeah, that's the like one just that I reviewed.
Yeah, that was crazy.
That's fucking massive. Like,
you write that at the start.
Yeah.
But there's, yeah, I mean, you wouldn't do that. But but there's also this thing that comics are now in a weird position where... they're being accepted by more and more people outside of what used to be the core element of comics, I suppose.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, boys of a certain age up to 35 or whatever. And, you know, and it's changed rapidly over the years. And so more people are coming to comics that maybe don't have the background, you know, they haven't read 2000 AD since they were six, and they haven't, like, done the kind of indie scene.
What's wrong with them?
Well, there is that. But they've come to it from a sideways thing where somebody that they know in the last 3 years has shown them comics for the first time that they've really enjoyed, and then they've gone, well, this is the medium. I've had a story to tell. I've tried writing it as a novel. It's not worked. I've tried writing it as a screenplay. It's not really worked. But comics is it. Comics is the one. And so you get these first-time writers and artists and that turning up in comics, and sometimes it's great. I mean, obviously, it's not always great, but sometimes it is really good. And I think there's a lot of publishers out there publishing these people, and I think, you know, it seems to upset a lot of people sometimes and everything, but it can only, I suppose, long-term benefit the medium if more and more people are accepting the work
in that one,
as a viable medium.
It was the framing of it, like, I couldn't get this made as a screenplay, so I thought...
Yeah, no, that's terrible.
I mean, if you just say, I've been working on this story for a while... and comics seems like the thing to make it in, that's fine. I guess this is the way you frame it. But yeah, I can understand what you mean. I mean, like that chap we had on from TKO, like, he's written for TV, but then he's gone and made comics.
And his heart's beating comics, isn't it? That's what I kind of admire about it. He knows the difference between, you know, which there is a huge difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm almost kind of like jealous of that kind of, you know, when you see somebody reading a book that you've loved and you've read loads of times and they're reading it for the first time.
Yeah.
Imagine somebody coming in late to comics and just finding out how bloody amazing it is as a storytelling device. And you kind of almost feel a little bit jealous about having that, you know, incredible feeling all over again about discovering.
I'd sort of sit there and chuckle and think, that's going to cost you a few quid, mate.
Yeah.
In my day, it was 12 pence.
Yeah.
We were bitching about that during the week, weren't we?
But I mean, that also reminds me, I was on a podcast, I was on Stuart Mulrain's podcast this week, Why Comics, and one of the things I said was, it's because I think it's the last sort of bastion of, like, truly unrestrained storytelling. You know,
there's, and creativity.
You know, people will say, oh, well, you can do so much in films, or you can do so much in this. Yes, but, you know, you could do in 20 pages something that would cost $400 million to make and no one would ever make it. You know, you could... There is no budget. There is no budget for comics. Yes, obviously.
Well, so they're not mucked about with. You look at a movie,
how
much is that mucked about with?
You
could be the best auteur in the world, you know, your own director of photography, but there'd still be 50 people involved in your film.
Yeah.
You know,
it's the old camel is a horse designed by a committee.
People are still telling David Lynch what he could and couldn't do when it came to a Twin Peaks TV series.
Striking bonkers.
We're living in that world.
And considering how old the medium is itself, I mean, we're looking at something that really kind of, like, spiked, you know, relatively late. You know, it's been around longer than film and photography, yet weirdly the French call it the ninth art, whereas it should have been called the seventh or something like that, or the sixth
You
know what I mean? It's like, it's still got so much potential that hasn't been tapped into yet, because the stuff that people could do with comics, I mean, we accept that what a comic book looks like, which is the flimsy sort of, like, thing, you know, 24 pages and a couple of adverts and, you know, page to page, we've got to make sure the action happens on the turnover and everything like that, but the stuff that could be done with that, with fold out pages and stuff like that within there and everything, where you can get the panels running in different directions, and people just, we haven't fully explored all of it yet.
I think with that as well, I was about to call it a crime, but that's a bit harsh. When it comes to the comic artwork, I think one of the things that can kill a comic's artwork for me is when it looks generic. When it looks cookie cutter, there's no character. I think ever since we started the show, we've seen such a huge range of different flavors and styles. You know, sometimes they come from the indies and bleed into the mainstream, or vice versa. You know, things like that. But when it's just almost the same and it's lifeless,
there's got to be an honesty to the line, isn't there? There's got to be something that isn't full of Photoshop special effects and, you know, it's like that. Yeah, poser or something.
You know, like with like the DC, and they try and get House Star, and you pick up a comic and it's just really, sometimes it's really bland.
Yeah.
It's just like the same faces. But when they, like, an artist shines and they've got their style, like, I'm fucking on board with that. It's, I'd rather someone in their own style and not 100% than someone who's kind of really generic and just bland and not interesting.
Yeah. I think those words house style are quite scary.
Yeah.
Maybe not for a lot of readers who just, you know, they like their flavour, don't they? They like their Big Macs and they don't want to try anything else. They know what they're getting. And that must be the thinking of the term house style, isn't it? You know, these people want this flavour. Let's give it to them.
Trouble is when kind of the house style, it kind of like think of product.
Yeah.
And when you're just kind of creating these comics for product, it kind of, I know that's part of the business, but it brings that too much to me, and I'm like, oh god.
And
not scaring the audience as well, because sometimes, you know, when you look at somebody's work who's kind of like, you know, the work's off kilter, and again back to those kind of like 1-inch brushes and splatters,
yeah,
and stuff like that, and you know, stuff where they're drawing like a mad person and stuff like on one page, and then it's really beautiful, you know, pointless stuff on the next page to it and everything. That can, they may be worried that it's going to put off a mainstream audience. So they have these very realistic, you know, but very generic sometimes looking artists. But then you get other artists that do that realistic style, but in such a great way. People like Olivia Coppel and, you know, just fantastically realistic looking art, but still has a real flavour of their own to it where you can spot it a mile off.
Yeah.
Should we swing this round to how about you create your work?
Yeah, that's nice.
Oh, well, okay. well, again, I think this year has been really odd because I've obviously kind of done a number of things. And one of the things I did was in November, I bought an iPad, my first iPad, with the intention of sort of creating more art in a different way. But I've been, I've always been sort of like somebody who does like thumbnails in my sketchbooks. And when I'm working stuff out, so that's normally the place that I'll start, or I'll start with character sketches and things like that. I think I did that with you, Vince, right?
Yeah.
When we were doing that book, I sent a page of like drawings of different faces, and I ticked a couple that I thought were right and for the characters and stuff like that. So sometimes that.
And then you got a message back going, "Fucking hell."
But it was great. It was nice to be, you know. So once that was done, then I thought, right, now I can just focus on other things and everything. Yeah. I think some of the first stuff I sent you actually was drawings of the lighthouse, wasn't it? Because I think you sent a message saying I wanted to do something with a lighthouse, and I just thought lighthouses are cool. Why haven't I drawn many of these before? So I just sent a bunch of lighthouse drawings, which was great fun. So that's kind of fun in collaboration and stuff like that. But thumbnails in my sketchbook was always the way to go. But I have done a project this year. Which is done and dusted out the door now, and the whole project was done start to finish on my iPad, thumbnails and everything. And I think that was more of a kind of me, because I said it earlier, you know, I'm still finding my way, and I'm one of these people that I love lots and lots of different artwork, from like Bill Sienkiewicz through to sort of like Michael Gaidos's artwork, and you know, then realistic stuff like I mentioned with Olivia Coppel. And then, you know, cartoony stuff, and I found myself bouncing around sometimes as how I want to solve a problem, which, you know, what influences are going to sort of like come to bear on the artwork, and then with the digital stuff that I'm playing with as well, I'm kind of like mixing and matching. So sometimes I'm doing stuff where I've penciled it all, you know, on paper, and then scanned it, and then I'm inking it digitally, and you know, and I've, you know, I'm sure at some point, what was really interesting to watch was watching Frank Quitely working on that little documentary he did. Where you see him working kind of digitally for the pencils and stuff like that, and then he prints it out and then inks it by hand. So, you know, it's
kind of the opposite of what a lot of people do, isn't it?
Great as well. And it's lovely to see that. There is no restriction, really, with what it is what you want to do with it. And, you know, if you want to, you know, you mentioned earlier about sort of like poser figures and stuff like that, where it's kind of like, you know, working with those kind of things. But I've built 3D models and stuff like that, and you know, but I'm making my own stuff. I'm not just pulling it down off the internet.
Yeah, I think I'm more sort of the ones that just really show out, that they're just you know, there's a bit of that going on, isn't there? Yeah, but I know, I completely understand why people use them. We're going to talk, I think we're talking about an artist later who was quite famous for using them years ago, but has moved onwards, you know.
But I've even made card models and stuff like that, or plasticine figures and stuff like that, to get kind of shadows and everything, right? So you use whatever's to hand, and that's the nice thing about it. But yeah, I mean, I'd say generally still I'm very much kind of like thumbnails, usually my thumbnail pages, so I'll do full pages at thumbnail, and they're usually about 3 inches by about 4 inches, maybe something like that sort of size in my sketchbook, so I can maybe get 9 on a page.
Do you photograph much? Do you act it out or get your partner to act out things and photograph the movement?
If it's something difficult and weird, yeah. But it's kind of odd because, I mean, with my own stuff, it's okay because the lead character in the comics looks like me. So, and that was purposeful because I'm the cheapest model. You know what I mean? It's like, it's
don't do yourself down. You're not that cheap.
And but yeah, I will use, you know, I'll do stuff like that. And I'm constantly, when I'm out, you know, I'm constantly going, oh wow, look at that crazy fire escape on the side of that building. I'll photograph that and use that later, and you know, things like that. And I don't necessarily, you know, I don't think I really trace over photographs. I mean, you might see I've got some stuff online where you can see me working, and even if I'm using reference, I'll have the reference next to me and I'll draw it. So, you know, I'm not really tracing over stuff so much. It's like it's more, I'm using the reference and then trying to still get my own version of the drawing in there and stuff like that. But you've
created some fantastical stuff, dude. I mean, like, and you're not afraid of a background, for instance. But just seeing some of your concept work and your prints, like you have like large format prints and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful. What I love about seeing Gareth's work is I'm a big fan of, like, you know, when you get the concept art books for movies.
Yeah.
And you see all this amazing stuff.
There's a lot of them about now. You never used to get many. There's
loads of it.
It's so great. But, you know, I've got so many of them on my shelves now and everything. And there's always another one coming out this month. And you're just thinking, but I want it. I'm going to buy it.
And some of your large prints really remind me of those. You know, it's like a snapshot for a film that I never knew I needed in my life, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it kind of stems from, again, from my love of comics and stuff like that, and you know, and I love film, and you know, I watch a lot of movies and stuff like that, and I'm a massive fan of concept art for games and stuff. Even though I'm not particularly a big game player, but I was teaching games mostly around the production art side of it and sort of developing characters, and I love all that character concept art. I think that's brilliant. But with the prints that I was doing, my idea was to sort of, like, you know, almost kind of. Well, I've got comic book art on my walls, you know, pages from comic books and stuff like that, that the originals and stuff like that, as well as like sketches people have
done.
Come
on, give us a taste of what you got on your walls. What sits in front of you then as you draw?
A lot of the stuff in front of me is probably, I've got Mike Mignola prints and sort of the Raider prints upon the wall in front of me.
Nice.
I've also got a Batman sketch by Frank Quitely that I got from UKEC a long time ago. I think it was probably when it's over in Bristol or somewhere like that.
The expo. So
I've got one of those. I met Carl Baker as well.
Me and
my friend Andrew sat and chatted to him for ages. It was great. That was the first time I'd seen he's going, oh, I'm working on a comic book now. And what he had on the table in front of him was just like drawings, but all separate, almost like some of them torn and just thrown about on the table, and going, like this, you don't set up the page and draw the page. And he goes, I've got Photoshop, why do I need that? And it's the first time I ever heard somebody, an artist, talking about how they pieced it all together in Photoshop, which was crazy. So I've got a pencil sketch by, no, pen and ink sketch by Carl Baker. I've got a Dean Ormston tree monster behind me on the wall. And then I've got one wall just full of Duncan Fogredo stuff because he's been great. And he's done loads of great sketches.
I can see his influence on you, man. I can see that. Yeah, definitely.
I bought the Enigma when it came out. Do you know what I mean? And so I followed him right back then. And that was his first stuff for me, I suppose, and everything. And then
he's a great guy, and he's really approachable as well. He's always replying to stuff on Twitter, and he's a nice. We had. Do you remember at Nottingham a few years ago? We had dinner with him. Do you remember the?
Yeah,
he's a super guy. I love him to death. Yeah,
he's been really lovely. Yeah. And then I've got a couple of Dean Ormston original art pages, and I've got a Frank Quitely and John Stokes art page from The Invisibles on my wall further down.
Nice. That's
a favourite. I used to work with John Stokes. John Stokes came to work with us when I was working in the theme park industry. He turned up at the studios and everything like that, and I'm going to my bosses, do you know who this guy is, man? Do you know what he's worked on? And it was just like, it was great, because he used to come into the local comic shop in Norwich that I was at Abstract Sprocket, and we'd go in there and sort of like see him coming in and buying stuff and everything like that. And and he was just brilliant. And he came into work in the workshops at first, because he's a scenic painter for theatre backdrops and stuff like that, as well as a comic artist. And then he came into the studios and worked in the studios, and the level of everybody's drawing went up several notches. People just put him in a room. Absolutely brilliant, John Stokes. Anyway, he basically gave me the page, and it was just like as a kind of, because when the company all split up and everything, it was great. But lovely, lovely guy. So
nice one,
sweet.
So yeah, that's some of the stuff on the wall. So I'm kind of surrounded by that kind of work.
Talking about what you were saying there about Photoshop, is that something you guys feel a pressure on you to keep up with the next bit of technology that's coming in? Because it used to be like, you know, Kirby would just sit at his dirty old desk and draw in ink pages, wouldn't he? But now everything seems to sort of... I'm always seeing people going and recommending brushes or recommending programs or, you know, ways of doing stuff. Is that something you feel a pressure to keep up with?
It's interesting because, I mean, it depends on who you're watching. I mean, there's a lot of people online that sort of like talk about, you know, you can get this brush set. And some of the brush sets are great and wonderful and people try and replicate non-digital tools digitally and stuff like that. And that's always kind of interesting to watch. But one of my favourite things is when you're watching somebody, you know, like Feng Zhu on FZD or sort of like, you know, Scott Robertson and stuff like these concept artist guys who are really kind of doing that high-end stuff, not only working for film and television and games and stuff like that, but working for sort of like big car companies and stuff like that and doing kind of crazy sort of like concept work for them. And they'll go, yeah, I'm just using the round brush in Photoshop for this. And you're going, sometimes it's just an over-elaboration, do you know what I mean? It's like watching the people who do the vape smoking and they've got like 300 different pieces of kit on the table in front of them while they're doing it. Sometimes you don't need all of that stuff necessarily.
It's all smoke and mirrors sometimes, isn't it?
It's great to have it all. And as somebody who sort of like gets off on sort of like, you know, having stuff that's kind of fun to work with. But a lot of the new digital stuff I'm doing, like I say, since I got the iPad, I'm just doing in Procreate, which is like, what, $9.95 or something stupid?
Right, okay.
For the entire piece of kit, and then it updates as it goes along.
I mean, my plan is to get an iPad, hopefully soon. Well, soonish. Who knows when I'll get it, let's be honest.
Photoshop's getting more and more elaborate, having more and more stuff added to it, and it's great to go into Procreate, which is just like Photoshop with all of the kind of design tools stripped out of it.
I literally just want to use an iPad to create comics. Do you know what I mean?
The best example of this is Frank Cho, who just bought a book out of Biro sketches.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But I think he's supernatural, though. He can't say that's Biro. He's sold his soul to the devil.
He definitely has.
I've doodled on a billion post-it notes in Biro in my time, and I've never managed to do what that man
did. Like that.
Have you ever seen Kim Jung-ji working?
Yeah.
I mean, what is that? Yeah. That's like, you know, whatever brush he has in his hand or pen he has in his hand, and then he just does it, and he's got this kind of, I don't know, eidetic memory where he's seen something once and he can draw it from every angle. God, it's just madness.
It is mad, yeah.
In terms of like sort of programs and stuff though, Tony, I think for me, I mean, I know Photoshop and stuff, but like I say, it's moving so fast that, you know, I essentially know what I need to know to get the stuff done. I mean, if some people see my work and they go, oh, you know, did you do this layer or did you do this effect and do that, they've probably lost me after the second line, because I kind of think, well, I just do whatever works for the piece. Do you know what I mean? I'm not really thinking, right, I'm naming all this, I'm doing all this. I mean, I do name my layers, I have learned that. Jesus.
I'm one of those terrible people that does everything in one layer. I'll keep the pencil separate on a separate layer, and then I'll do everything pretty much.
I don't know what a layer is, but even I know that you're a crazy person.
Yeah, you're a crazy person.
It upsets designers when they're sitting next to me watching me, and I'll just flatten everything down, and they go, "What are you doing?
I tell you what, Stuart Mulrain is cheering at the moment because Andy
he doesn't know what a layer is either. I've had it off him; he doesn't know what it means.
No,
what Troy's trying to explain it. You know, like in the old school when they used to do animation and they put all the layers of acetate.
That's kind of what I thought it was. Yeah,
yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's a great use. It's a useful tool. There's no two ways
about it. Yeah, but I don't know, like, you know, all these different effects. You know, I just want to know what will just create the comics that I want to create. I mean, although knowing, for instance, like a halftone brush, you know, to do some sort of effect. I'd love to, you know, I'm looking forward to learning these little tricks, but, you know, I'm going to have to
scan stuff as well. You can just scan stuff and you'll take photo. I mean, you know, the phones are that great nowadays. You can just photograph something, bring it in, and then just beat it up in Photoshop a little bit and then put that in as a, you know, if you want somebody's like crashing through a wall and you want that kind of explosive effect, I'll still sometimes just drip ink on a page and then photograph it and add that in rather than using a paint splatter tool, because sometimes they look a little mechanical.
I don't think you can ever not. I think it benefits everyone to at least try like physical paper and pen and ink or brushes or whatever.
But using both together, you're basically breaking. People say, you know, I've always said about software, and I used to say to students and stuff like that, it's like, you know, you don't let the software bend you to its will, because this is how things are done, and that software programmers have allowed this to happen, so this is how it needs to be done. Bend the software to you, your will, even if you're pushing it to breaking point, so you're having to mix traditional skills with digital skills. Use them both. Yeah. Sometimes one is going to be better for a job than another, and the next job that comes around, it's going to be the inverse of that. They're just tools at the end of the day. I mean, Photoshop and all that lot. You know, you look at dodge and burn, the symbols for dodge and burn in Photoshop are basically traditional darkroom tools. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, a lot of people don't remember that, but, you know, it's there because that's what these things are. They're designed to be hybrided, really.
Yeah. Just so you know, Tony, dodge and burn are a couple of 70s detectives. They're just
Photoshop. They sound like Little and Large, something like that.
Right, dodge. Right, burn.
To you.
Have I just turned them into some weird 70s Chuckle Brothers?
They're going to be in a comic with Jimmy Jangles. Jimmy Jangles takes on Dodge and Burn. That's it. Done.
Ringing up Prince Philip. The backup.
All right, then. How about this for a little sort of a process question, as it were? How many panels is it before you start to worry? If you see a script, how many panels is it before you start to think, oh no?
This is interesting. I'm gonna write down the number
per page.
I'm writing down a number now. All right, okay.
Let's all write down a number.
Yeah.
Right.
You guys answer, because I'm obviously the one writing the scripts to get people to draw them. So I've got a kind of thing in my head where I know if I do one more than this, it will stress them out. But yeah.
So this is the maximum before this is the maximum you're comfortable with. And any more than this, and it will.
I'm not sure I'm the right person to ask, but I think if it's a regular workaday kind of like comic book page, I don't think I'd, you know, where there's a lot of stuff happening in every panel, and it's not a stylistic approach where, you know, there's going to be 60 panels on this page, but they're going to get smaller and smaller until the last one's like 3 millimeters or whatever, because that wouldn't frighten me. That's just cool, you know, when you see something weird and that's happening like that. Or that, you know, the page has got to look like a piece of glass that's been broken and shattered, and every single piece of glass is a panel. That's cool, you know. But 9, I suppose, would be 9.
Oh, that's quite high.
That is quite high. I mean,
yeah. I usually try not to go more than 5.
Okay. Well, for myself, you see, and this is probably part of the problem with my own stuff, is that I'll easily go past 9. Much higher.
For me, look for a script, and it's got to be like kind of waves. So to have a peak, you got to have the trough. If every single page is like 9, 10, 11, 9, 10, 11, whatever, it's like, Jesus Christ, they're not sure they know what they're doing here. But whether it's like one page is 5 or 6 and then another page jumps up and down accordingly, that's fine. When it's the foot's on the gas all the time, it's like maybe put this into 2 issues. You've got to have like that many panels per page.
And there's a lot to be said about inset panels or things like this. I mean, for instance, I'm working with on Gareth, I've done stuff where there's a lot of reactions, there's facial reactions, and but there's not so much said. Those things, they don't need to be a huge panel of someone like suddenly thinking about something. That can be a nice little inset.
We've just done an inset on the one I'm working with you, Vince, haven't we? Right at the end, there's a little gag answer, you know. And that kind of works. I don't mind that so much.
Yeah.
Looking at the old Roy of the Rovers, I was reading one during the week, and there's a lot of inset pages, inset panels with like heads talking.
Right.
Rather than having the whole massive panel with them talking, it's just like a little cutout frame, got the head in it, and saying, oh no, Joe Bloggs is about to score or something.
I mean, they do the odd floating head in that as well, don't they? They do a sort of circular floating head thing.
We're talking theories and hypotheticals right now. Yeah. Okay,
but to break a panel occasionally as well. I like to see
You have to be careful with those, though, don't you? I mean, it can get dangerous. You don't want people breaking out of every panel, although it's fun to do, but... You've got a page, and it's a conversation. Two people are chatting in a coffee shop. This is going to be a dialogue. Well, how heavy should we make the page, Tony?
I'd have to try and come up with a way to make it interesting. So it wouldn't be him, her, her. It would be, you know, something going past the window. It would be serving the breakfast, putting it on the table. You know, it would be, you know,
somebody tapping
aside.
The foot under the table.
Yeah.
It's like an empty wrapper from the previous person that's there or something like that. Somebody
picking
with
up the ketchup,
a wedding ring.
Something, you know, I would try and break it up. And I think there's, I like watching, I like reading conversations. I really do. I'm not put off by them, as long as they're not too wordy and they're natural.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to describe what you're saying in a panel. You can, what the words that are on the page, you have to cut back by the gesticulation that you trust your artist to use.
Yeah.
So if they're going, I don't really like that, they shouldn't be saying, no, I don't really like that. They should be saying, nah, and they should be making a face. You know, it's
there's
different ways. It's a difficult one, isn't it? It really is. It depends on the artist, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's the same way of like someone made in it said, oh, do you fancy doing this? And the other person said, well, I'm not really keen on that. If the artist's up to snuff, they could put the facial expression. You might not need the text.
Yeah. If someone's crying, you don't need the, I'm really sad about this. You just need the girl's name who's died, for example. Yeah. So, you know.
But that can be a bit of back and forth. Sometimes the art might need that bit of text. Sometimes it might not.
Yeah.
So that's a decision that, you know, in a collaboration, that can be discussed quite openly, can't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's work for hire, that might be just the decision of the writer at the end of the day. Yeah. I think I can't remember, I was listening to the other day, there was some writer talking about working with an artist, and he says, sometimes I'll just strip the dialogue out because the artist has done it in the panel.
Yeah.
I've fucked up and like done something like where someone's dodged something, like a bullet or something, and it's like, oh, that looks a bit shit. I'm not sure if people will get that. And it's like, someone's put, oh, he's missed. Or something like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I do it with my own stuff all the time because I tend to write and then do the artwork and then go back over it and then I'll change things. You know, it's like this conversation really doesn't work now the way that I've drawn it. So I'll just throw that out and just add a different kind of conversation. You know?
I think sometimes it's beneficial for those writers that maybe letter in, you know, the comics. I mean, I'm lettering stuff that I'm working, you know, with the pages that Gareth and I are working on, and we're going backwards and forwards with it. You know, in my script, maybe it was a little bit wordier. You know, he's done an awesome panel, and I realise I can cut back, and I can do that on the
David
fly.
Did that last week, didn't he?
Yeah,
and
I can rewrite on the fly as I'm looking at the speech bubble on the page, and you know, not changing the story, but just tweaking it so you realise, oh, I can say this in three words what I put eight words for. You know,
I think the action that happens in it dictates how the words should be treated. If you sit, people sitting in a cafe, they can have a conversation. But if you're running, you know, 100-meter race, you're not going to get a whole conversation out. Or if you're swinging an axe in a battle, you know, it doesn't need to be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It needs to be really cut back.
Although we did, you know, just so everyone knows, on the WhatsApps between the three of us on the pod, we did have a bit of a discussion. We weren't ragging on anything, but we had a discussion about a comic from one of the big two where there was a fight scene and it was one of the biggest dialogue pages I've seen in quite some time while people are having a fight.
And that's from somebody who's never had a fight. You're so fucking knackered when you're
out of breath.
Yeah.
There's a infamous panel or splash page in a Cyberforce comic where the Ripclaw character's jumping off
easy
the tree.
Easy now, because I love that.
One of the girl that can run fast, and there's just text, loads of text of him speaking to her, like midair. okay.
Yeah.
Maybe do him speaking, then one more panel of him jumping.
Yeah.
You don't...
Yeah. There's only so much you can say as you're jumping in the air. Let's face it. Yeah.
Normally it's just, I made it.
Shit.
No, that's when you're falling, Dan. Two very different things. I can jump up in the air, it's just coming back down that I have a problem with.
I just shout, who needs pyjamas? That's what I normally shout.
That's when you come jumping out of the speeding vehicle.
Or the wardrobe.
In the nurse's home.
Oh,
there
dear.
We go, off the rails.
Off the rails, and I think that's just about time to wind up the comic. I mean, we covered a lot of ground there, I think, so hopefully you people got a lot from it. And thank you very much, Gareth, for your insight.
And we'll talk a little bit about your upcoming projects in a minute as well, won't we, I'm sure.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Cool.
We will. Oh, don't worry. We're probably going to be talking about your work for quite some time, even when you're not on the show, so...
Oh, well, that's good.
Before we came up, I managed to blag a sketch of Gareth at the 200 show, and I've got it framed. of the Pendragon character Vanguard, because it's fucking awesome.
Yeah. Nice. Oh, bless. There's so much love in this room right now. Yeah.
I love the stamp you did as well. It's like you got the rubber stamp with the
red ink.
I just fucking...
Yeah, I use those on my prints because I just thought it can, it just adds a little sense of authenticity, I suppose.
This is a great thing.
Somebody knows they've got something real because,
it's a great touch that basically me and Dan want to steal, basically.
Yeah, next week I thought, how can I get a stamp? And I go, what would I put on it? That's where I stopped thinking about it.
Yeah.
I got mine made really locally. There's a guy in Hull that sort of like I got 9 made, so with different sort of like things on, so I could vary as I wanted. And I just thought they were really cool. But there were, you go online and you look at them and you're thinking, oh yeah, they're fairly reasonable. But I just went local and there was some guy that works in a fabrication place that does it as a side within the business. And they were just brilliant. And I loved
them. Nice.
Yeah. So I try to buy as much stuff in the city as I can, so the money stays in the city. But it's just like, that was great, and I use them for loads of stuff now. So,
yeah. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So come on. I'm curious about this, and everyone listening is curious. What's happening with Spacewalk? What's the story there, my friend? Tell us what you can around that.
Well, I'm still working on stuff. I'm still sort of like to and fro and backwards and forwards, sort of like some concept stuff really for sort of like certain characters and things like that. I've nailed a few different pieces.
So for those that don't realise, just quickly, Space Warp is kind of Pat Mills has written all the stories, and he's taken a lot of time and a lot of care in picking artists out, and rightly so, he's chosen you.
Yeah.
And he's given you a sort of outline of the story, or he's given you a script? Is that how it's worked? Or?
Yeah, there was a script ready to go when I came to the project. There's huge outlines sort of like of the world that it's all set in, which links a lot of the stories together because there's like an overarching sort of like idea for Spacewalk itself.
Yeah.
And the execution story that I'm working on is just one kind of strand within that. It's great to sort of... Be working on something that where the story is really kind of like well thought out, and Pat's obviously got sort of like very coherent ideas of what he wants to sort of like appear and everything like that, I'm really enjoying sort of like the process of sort of like to and fro in the art to sort of like get it right, and we're getting closer and closer to I think to sort of like nailing everything. I've actually thumbnailed most of the all of the book out,
right?
So it's all there. But obviously, that's thumbnails are just this kind of vague notion of them. But
you finished some pages, haven't you? There's some finished pages.
Yeah, page one's definitely finished and everything, and that's all done because there's nothing on that page that's still in kind of flux. But there's a couple of things across some of the other pages where there's still some ideas in flux. So, but they're all the pages are done. The layouts and everything are all done and everything. It's just a case of getting the last few details of some of the concepts and everything together so that Pat's happy with those and everything, and then I'll just lay it all in.
Yeah. I had a cheeky. They sent a little cheeky look at it for me. Lisa said, "Oh, rather than send you a Get Well card, I'm going to send you some of Gareth's artwork while I was in the hospital." Yeah, that was nice, man. It's looking fucking awesome. You've put the work in around the designs as well. They were
fucking amazing.
Yeah. Really we will put a link in the show notes to Pat Mills' video of him. That's on YouTube, isn't it?
That was surreal.
Yeah,
that was a surreal moment. It was lovely, but it was absolutely surreal. I sat there and watched it with Sarah, and my head turned inside out.
Did you get emotional?
Yeah, I did. Of course, yeah.
Yeah,
it's good, man. They were cracking. Yeah. The amount of work you put into it was like the smallest different changes in the character designs you did, and. Genius.
I suppose that comes from the other side of the stuff that I do with the concept art and everything like that. Yeah. So I like trying to get things right, cause, But that's been an interesting thing, and working on this project, that background, I suppose, has proved a little bit useful in making sure that I'm producing stuff that Pat's happy with. So
there's a little bit of the ABC Warriors, a little bit of Nemesis, there's a little bit of that sort of feel to it as well, isn't there?
Nasty
sci-fi,
And I, we're all hugely looking forward to it. And I know our listeners, you definitely got to check out the video because on it, like Pat, not only is he laughing, which just makes me smile through the whole thing as he's looking through all these designs, but you really get a good look at the sort of concept work that Gareth does,
At that point, you kind of look at it and you're thinking, if this year is my only crack at doing this in comics and everything, that is something that I can take away and be really happy about.
Right, exactly. You've already smashed it, dude. But there's tons
and
more.
And you should be looking at some of the other guys' artwork as well, and there's some other good stuff.
Oh, God,
yeah. It's going to come together really nicely. So.
Yeah, it's going to be a beautiful comic, that. That's just, I can't wait for that. And who knows? Well, I actually do know that when that comes close to fruition, we're going to get Pat on the show again. So
yeah, definitely. Cool. Yeah.
So look forward to that. And more Gareth work. But he's sticking around with us for the next bit while we talk a load of shit and recommend some great stuff. We do.
Yeah, that's true.
And we recommend a couple of books for you people to go on with your working week or whatever you're doing in your life. But before that, do we have any shout-outs, gents?
Yeah, I've got a few. So big shout to Rick Jackson and Nick Prolix, who I've met up separately this week for a coffee. It's always nice to meet up with people you collaborate with and had a proper laugh with them, and good to see what they're doing and the work they're doing at the moment. Really nice.
Yeah.
Big shout to Helena, who is, you can find her on Twitter at Penciling the J, just the letter J, Penciling the J, or you can find her at the website art92.com, art92.com. She drew Sharknado for a bit of a warm up.
Nice. Awesome.
Yeah, she's like, lovely, like over the moon, and I'm buying it off her. Is if you've got a dog and you need a picture of it, look her up. It's like just outstanding stuff. Just like cheer me up no end. Big shout to Stuart McCune. I back everything that Stuart does, and he's a thoughtful and interesting and professional creator who knows how to do a Kickstarter. He's got Noir, a dark sci-fi collection. It's from the mind of Mr. McCune, a collection of interconnected dark sci-fi stories. They go on Kickstarter, so look up Noir.
Is he on Kickstarter again?
He's got another one. Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah. He's a beast. He's
pumping it out. Yeah, he is. Yeah. I subscribe to his drip, which is a bit like a Patreon thing. And I've just upped my amount so I can get the physical copies because it's looking brilliant. Just like absolutely brilliant. So go back to that. Celia Jade Mitchard, she runs Celia's Place in Midsummer Norton, which sounds like a sort of carrot town outside Bath somewhere, which it is. And she's got the genius idea of cutting people's hair and selling comics all at the same venue. If you go to our Facebook group, she is having I think she's been open for a year, so she's having a bit of an event. And she's looking for small press people to include themselves, maybe send comics, maybe appear, do a sign-in, do some drawing, and that's on the 7th of September at Celia's Place in Midsummer Norton. You know where that is, V, don't you?
Yeah, it's just down the road from me.
There you go. So have a look for that.
Lovely place.
There,
a couple of quick Kickstarter ones from me.
Yeah.
MPCT issue 7 by Sarah Millman.
Nice.
It has smashed it. But a great opportunity to get in on this series. It's one of the best indie series out there, and Milmo's always, she's one of the gang now. So you definitely check that out. Another Kickstarter that I discovered, I've been trying to kick it. I've been trying to really...
Oh, I'm up to like 80 odd now.
Every time I think I'm out, they pull me back in. and it's purely... So I went on another hiatus, and someone posted a retweet, I think, or I just backed this, those tweets, you see.
Yeah, they work.
And I saw the cover for Tomb of the White Horse. And this is by Ian Mondrick, Benjamin A. Philby, Leslie Atlansky, and Zach Sam. And it basically, as a blizzard descends upon a remote distribution center, a mysterious package is delivered. The three-man night crew will be witness to unspeakable horrors born from within the Tomb of the White Horse. And then I backed it. The cover was enough to sell it on me anyway. I think I posted it on Twitter, actually. It's just like a one-shot horror comic. As we speak, I think they're a few hundred off their goal. 23 days to go as we speak. Well, 22 as we say now, but definitely worth checking because also the artwork inside and sketches that you can see on the page look really great as well.
I think because the video was so bad this week because it made me chuckle so much.
Yeah. But a video that was good for me was a big shout out to Cliff Cumber, who posted up a bit of video of him receiving a bit of artwork that I sent him. He's got a smooth, silky voice, hasn't he?
I've not heard him talk before.
I know. It just made me feel all kinds of emotions.
He's been sending me photographs this week for our comic. He's been posing.
Easy now. Yeah. Spoilers.
Although we did discuss nudity.
Yeah. I know. So, yeah, we know some of the topics that your comic's about. So we worry about you, Cliff, if you send him photo ref. Yeah, but he posted a very, very far too kind video about receiving this piece of artwork that I did for him. And I won't lie, made me a little bit emotional. Yeah, there you go.
Emotional in your pants.
Emotional all over.
Oh, nice.
Mm. Emotional in my pants. Really?
You said it.
The thing
let's
is,
get it on t-shirts. Let's get it on t-shirts.
Emotional in my pants. Yeah.
Listen to the AOS Awesome Comics podcast.
Yeah.
It'll make you emotional in your pants.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I think that'll work. Anyway, have you got any shout-outs, Dan?
Yes, for the Leamington Comic Con, which is the 5th of October from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. We have to put the details up on the in the link, but it's at the All Saints C of E Church, Priory Terrace, Leamington Spa.
Yeah, you're going to have a laugh and I'm not going to be there.
Yeah.
That's not why we're going to have a laugh, though, Tony.
You'll laugh at me.
We're going to miss you.
I know.
We'll take selfies.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be in New York with... get this for a lineup.
Oh, here we go.
Wild Goose.
Nice.
Harris. Cumber. Look at that. Fantastic Four.
I wonder which one is Ben Grimm.
I wonder.
More like John Carpenter's the thing. Hey! He knows I love him. Yeah. And anyway, enough of that nonsense. See, I said we talk shit. So,
yeah, you're right.
You get what it says on the tin. Yeah. And likewise, we want to send you people off with some recommendations for the week. So who wants to go first?
Oh, I got two. I got a really short one and a longer one. So shall I start and then...
Yeah, go on.
Unless you got two. Have you got two as well?
No, I've only got one.
I've got the one.
Okay. The Age of the Caveman, created by Taya Ozcan, published by Marcosia, out next month, full colour. Full colour, it's kind of some pages like washes, you know?
Yeah.
149 pages. Taya is, I'm completely ashamed of myself for never having seen his work before. He's a Turkish creator. He's also been published in Heavy Metal with this caveman character is a bit of a sort of trademark of his. He's done some DC comics. I think he was in a DC Vertigo series called Gangland. But he's been translated in loads of different languages and stuff like this. And this is a big 149-page collection of very short stories about a caveman. They're obviously easy to translate because it's like, I think in the whole book there's like four words or something. But it's got a very sort of, it's got a stylized sort of undergroundy feel to it, which is very readable as well. There, I'd probably compare it to sort of saucy Mad magazine style, maybe. Right. You know what I mean? Sort of that sort of gag strip. This is, as I say, a collection of short stories. But what they do is they parallel situations today. So there might be he finds the humor in, or the satire in what happens to a caveman, and he compares it to what happens to us now. From the sort of obvious, there's just little things like there's a caveman chewing the bones of an animal that he's caught, and he's throwing the bones over his shoulders, and then you flip to a sort of a town centre where there was city centre where it's just big piles of rubbish next to dustbins. So he does that sort of little knowing humour. Some of them are sort of a bit more saucy than that, some of them a bit more funny. There's one where the caveman, he just wanders around and he keeps seeing the shape of boobs and bums in the shape of clouds. You know, he looks up in the cloud and he thinks, oh, that looks like boobs. You know, he sees a tree and he thinks, that looks like a lady's bum. And then it flips to, you skip forward to now, and there's a man sitting there reading a book of erotic drawings whilst his gorgeous girlfriend sits next to him, frustrated and ignored. You know, it's that sort of thing. There's other commentaries on modern art and violence and sex and relationships and greed and money. And it's a clever way, without hitting you over the head, to say, look, what the fuck are we doing with ourselves these days? You know, it's often quite relevant, actually. You'd be surprised. These sort of funny caveman drawings that he's clearly been doing for decades, I think, can be quite sort of poignant. He appears, I think, in a couple of them as a sort of an artist character. And I fucking absolutely loved it. I showed it to Nick yesterday when I met him. I got a sort of preview copy through from Harry Marcos, and it's really, really readable. It's sort of slightly outspoken as well. And it's outspoken in the right way, not in the sort of bitching, whiny social media bullshit we see now, you know. And I'll tell you what, Taya knows how to draw. He can draw a great figure. Really, really good stuff. It's, as I say, it's got that Mad Magazine aesthetic to it. You can see him side by side in the magazine next to Mort Drucker or Jack Davis or Bill Elder or John Severin, you know, stuff like that. And then right in the last sort of third of the book, what he does, he flips it. So he sends the caveman into the future, so beyond our own time, and compares the future to caveman times in a sort of hilarious way. He does, reader beware, he doesn't sort of shy away from sexual and violent moments. It's a bit, there's a bit of the caveman stroke saucy seaside postcard about it, maybe swap with a bit of Zap magazine, something like that. Real breath of fresh air. I was really, really pleasantly surprised about, I know, shouldn't be surprised how good it is because they do good books, but I was really pleasantly surprised with this book, and it was just something different, something readable. Go over to www.tayer, so it's TayerOzkan.com, or you can go to Marcosia.com, which is at Marcosia, MarkosiA, and you can pre-order the book over there. It's say 149 pages. It's not bad. It's a really good read. It took me sort of three or four sittings to work through it because it's all like short gag strips. Yeah, it's real fun, really good stuff. That's my first one. There you go, guys.
Nice. Who wants to go next? Dan?
I don't want to go next. Yeah. I was going to initially talk about a book that Tony got me, but I'm going to talk about another book Tony got me. Going to be Sam Zabel and the Magic Pen.
By
Dylan Horrocks, which I really love, but I want to do a bit more kind of rather than just bang it off the top of my head because I really enjoyed it. I'm going to write a little bit up and then talk about it on the next show.
Oh, nice.
Because I really enjoyed it. But the other one I'm going to talk about is for my birthday, Tony got me Sogio Jimbo Saga Book 3.
Oh, nice.
Which is absolutely fantastic all the way through. But there's one story that stuck with me that is the San Sakai is like so great with the character and Usagi in general, and it's called Death and Taxes.
Right.
So for those who don't know, it's set in feudal Japan, and Usagi Yojimbo is like a masterless samurai, and he comes across the town and they're having a big celebration. He's like, oh, what's going on? They go, they just finished their tax year. They've got all the money from the harvest, and they're going to take it to the local city and get it banked. So Usagi's like, well, I'm a bodyguard. Do you want to hire me?
Right.
And this old boy says, no, we don't need that. We'll be fine. He goes, okay. So he says, where's this town? And they go, well, it's over that way. It's a bit of a mission. So this old boy says, I'll walk you there. It's not a problem. So Usagi and this old boy go off for a walk in the mountains, and they look down and they see the cart that's taking the taxes to the city being robbed by these bandits. And Usagi's like, look, you should have hired me, man. I could have solved this. And he goes, oh, it's okay. We'll be fine. So they carry on. And some bandits come out of the bushes to say, oi, old man, we kind of, samurai, give us all the money you got. They don't. So Usagi cats them down. So a couple of day later, they get to this village. And Usagi's like, oh, thanks for showing me the way. I think I probably got lost in the mountain. The old boy's like, well, you're going to give me any money? And he's like, what? He's like, I showed you the way. You should give me some money. And he's like, oh, bloody hell. All right, here you go. He gives him the money. Usagi goes off. And then the old boy, a magistrate comes up. And he says, oh, you're here to pay the taxes? He goes, yeah, I've got them in the pack here. He says, also, we killed 3 bandits on the way. So you can give me the bounty for them too. So... in this story, Usagi's been completely mugged off by this old fellow who's the village elder. But the storytelling of Stan Sakai and
it's so good.
It's so good. I haven't done it justice in the telling, but the kind of the artwork, the pacing, he's just so on point. And there's so much of Usagi Yojimbo out there to read.
Yeah, I've been reading it for decades, and it's never got old.
Yeah.
It's just so well told. And he does interplay between people, and some of them are like little detective stories, and some of them a demon might turn up, and little recurring characters here and there. I love it so much, man.
He's sort of like the research in the period's really on point. I mean, he knows stuff. And it can swap because Usagi's this sort of like wandering swordsman. But one minute he is kind of like a very zen-like. The next minute, like Tony said, it's a detective story or there's supernatural elements. And each one's like a little story, but there's an overall arc of like building on the main character and the people around him.
From the one you mentioned, it sounds like there's a real kind of understanding of that traditional fable storytelling as well, because it feels like it slots into that kind of storytelling as well.
Exactly, yeah. It's kind of the point where you know...
As well, have you read the one where it's basically War of the Worlds versus Usagi?
Yeah.
That's a great one as well. He just clearly wanted to do that for fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did it. There's one, I think the fourth or fifth trade where... you've kind of got to know Usagi quite well and all these friends and foes, and there's like an enemy of the shogunate, and they've got like these black powder, the tempo guns, and they're going to take over the government. So Usagi leads like a kind of dirty half dozen, him, friends and enemies, to attack this castle, the fortress, and not all of them make it out. And it's a real kind of like, fucking hell, I didn't expect to see that character go down like that. But it's got that kind of the loss and...
Yeah, people die, don't they, and stuff. Yeah, people die. Yeah, yeah. I reckon go for the second... There's some big old... I think the one I got you was like a big old phone book kind of one. Is that the one?
Yeah.
I got you? Yeah, there's go for the second or the third one. Don't go for the first one. The early, I think it's Fantagraphics, were slightly differently drawn. He was still finding his feet a bit, I think.
Yeah.
But it's been consistently good like that. There's Space Usagi as well, which is worth a giggle. But it's just consistent, good artwork for, what, 3 decades now, you know, Italy. I'm surprised it's not something you're into, V. I can see that being...
It's one of those ones that I've always been meaning to...
you'd really like it.
Like start. Yeah. I remember having I think it was Lawless, having a huge conversation with Steve Sims and Tom Curry about it.
Yeah. Well, it's just started with IDW. You can pick up the first 2 issues quite easily, I would think. There was a bit of criticism of the colour on the new IDW series. I found it a little bit on the nose, but it's kind of settled down a bit in issue two. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still good though.
Yeah. Nice. Great series. Great character.
Yeah.
Cool. Nice. Okay. I'll do my one next. It's going to be a quicker, shorter, sharper one. A Dark Horse book. I haven't bought a Dark Horse book in quite some time. And the writer is Jeff Lemire. Artist is Mike Diodato Jr. I got that right, didn't I? The colorist is Frank Martin. The letterer is Steve Wands. This is created by Lemire and Diodato Jr. And this is Berserker Unbound. Now, this is an interesting one. Why was this my recommendation? Certainly, anyone who may know me will know me as someone that isn't really a fan of Diodato's work.
Mm.
Yes, there was a few things that I liked, but on the whole, it just wasn't for me. I know he worked with Marvel for the longest time, didn't he?
I actually was a bit worried when he left, because he's been such a mainstay of the company for so long.
Yeah,
you know.
But that's fair enough. If you like his stuff, it was just never for me, and that was one of the things that I thought I didn't really realize, because it was this cover for Berserker Unbound. Was one of my picks, I think, for my covers of the week sort of thing.
Yeah.
And to cut a long story short, imagine Conan the Barbarian waking up in New York City, modern day. That's literally what it seems to be. But you know, coming from someone like Jeff Lemire, there's going to be layers to it. There's going to be so much more going on. He's one hell of a writer. We've spoken about him quite a few times over the past few weeks. Whether it be his work in Valiant or the independent books, whatever, this man knows how to write. I'll tell you what, has he ever written Conan or Red Sonja or anything like that?
Oh, I don't know, man.
This is the book. It's Conan in everything but name, essentially, it seems to be. And issue one is very much like that. On the cover, you see the Mongrel King, as he's called. He's standing in a traffic jam in a New York City. That cover in itself just sells it, because you just think, right, okay, what is this? It's an obvious sort of idea, man out of time, out of place kind of thing.
Yeah. But
because it's a barbarian, you know, that got me more interested. And at that point, I didn't know Diodato Jr. had done it. So I picked it up, flicked through it, and Jesus Christ. this book... I would say you can't really tell. It functions like a sort of normal Conan book for most of it. It's literally only the last couple of pages is he's in modern day. The rest of it, you see him in his world. It's not much of a spoiler there. You just see him kicking ass in his own sort of what's the Conan world?
Stimeria.
Yeah. Stimeria. In this comics version of that kind of world, you see him just absolutely smashing up some fools. He's been on a long journey. He comes back. His family have been murdered. And then the tribe turn up that murdered his family. And you get two essentially splash pages, one of which I took a screenshot of and sent to the lads before we recorded. The artwork in this kind of blew me away. It was stunning. Like from panel to panel, it was jaw dropping. You know, this is someone who's clearly he's wanted to do this book. There is brutality, kind of like on the scale of some of the stuff we see in you know in Europe comics. You see those wonderful sort of like fantasy or historical stories that don't hold back. This is like that. Mixed with Lemire's sort of narration, it's just completely on point. I don't want to spoil too much. There's some nice sort of textures and art styles to this work that I haven't seen in Mike's work before.
Yeah, he's just come off Savage Avengers, and he was phoning that in. That was like one panel a page on occasion. Yeah,
really?
Yeah, this looks much better.
Really?
If he's done more, and there are pages of this that are, there's a lot of splash pages and an artist wanting to have fun, and like he's playing with, you know, it's very warm colours, looks very bloodthirsty to begin with. The narration, you know, there are F words, do you know what I mean? It's not your kiddies Conan. And then he basically gets transported. You got the classic, he comes to a portal and wakes up in modern day New York, which is a reveal that's kind of spoiled by the cover. It may have, even though the cover sold me on it, might have been nice for that to be a complete
surprise. Yeah, you can see where they shot their load on that image, because it's great, isn't it? Is he sat amongst a load of cars or something like that?
But when he wakes up, he wakes up in Central Park. So it's just on the page, it just looks like a forest until he turns around. And there seems to be a homeless guy poking him with a stick. And it has a bit of a conversation going, oh, why, you know, you're all fucked up, because he's injured at the time. And which led to the amazing line that you don't normally see in a fantasy book. Well, you ain't getting anywhere near my shit. Got it? Fabio? Fabio.
Fabio.
I'm calling you Fabio from now on.
Naming a barbarian Fabio is just the best thing ever. And then the character suddenly realizes he's in a completely different world. It's great. I'm definitely in for the next few issues to see what happens in this. So Berserker Unbound number one just came out last week.
This week, man, is Jason Aaron's Conan is fucking off and running. Really,
really
good.
Nice.
Really, really. I haven't read a proper Conan comic in quite some time.
But, yeah, you can pick these up. There's some really Thothamon. There's some really great stuff going on. Yeah. Really nice.
I picked up those. I think it's some of my favourite looking stuff since the Kerry Nard stuff in the other collections.
Yeah. Lovely. Harry Brown's done some stuff in here. It's really interesting. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We love a barbarian here on this show.
Absolutely.
Hell yeah.
Mm. Right, who wants to go next? We have Gareth. What would you like to recommend to our lovely listeners?
I'm trying to think of a sort of like stuff that I don't have a pull list or anything, so I tend to sort of like go in and sort of like pick up stuff and then go back and collect collections and stuff like that. And I've been looking at a lot of old 2000 AD stuff, I suppose, stuff that I missed in the middle period where I wasn't collecting sort of like it and everything. And a little while ago, I picked up The Red Seas, which the collection of Ian Edgerton and Stevie. I love that. So like that's right on point with stuff that I just like. I like all the occult stuff and the pirates and everything. It's just got all the food groups in it for me. I liked Cabalistics Inc. I've got the collection of that.
Is that Gordon Rennie?
Awesome looking stuff. I mean, the artwork, and it's just beautiful and that. Again, reminded me of like Michael Gaidos' stuff in Inferno that he did with Mike Carey for Back in Calibre days and stuff like that.
Okay.
So that was kind of cool. What else have we been looking at? I picked up the House of X and stuff, I suppose, in new stuff and everything.
We've been going nuts on the WhatsApp around those. We're loving what's happening in that, man.
Yeah, that's been cool. So I'm looking forward to seeing more of that and everything. And I suppose other stuff that I've been collecting on a more semi-regular basis and everything. Obviously, it's nice that it's coming to the end and they're tying up a lot of the stuff to do with like Hellboy and the Hellboy universe and everything, BPRD and everything like that. So they're kind of topping and tailing that. But I'm assuming they're just going to go back and tell stories from the past in that, which is cool. Okay. But I love Eric Powell's stuff with Goon and Hillbilly as well. So it's nice to see all that stuff on the shelves as well. One weird one that was kind of like out of the blue that I picked up was a thing called Fair Lady, but I think it's a couple of years old now. But I picked up the first four issues of that. And that's a weird kind of like fantasy thing. It's kind of like a gender swapped version of Magnum PI, but set in a kind of like a D&D fantasy world.
Well, that sold me.
Yeah.
It's a really odd little thing. And the first couple of issues are basically one shots. So they're like single sort of like cases that the person's done. And I think they're kind of going to try and expand out of that. And it's got a map in it, which is always great. You're going to have a fantasy story, put a map in it.
That's an obligatory thing, I think.
And that's Brian Shermer writing that, and Claudia Balboni sort of like illustrating it. It's an image one. But I think, like I say, it's a couple of years old now, so I don't know where it's gone and everything like that.
It doesn't matter how old. Cool. It may be a couple of years old, but it'll be brand new to someone like me. Yeah. So that's going on.
And a weird one out of the blue was Cowl. I don't know if any of you guys have come across that.
Yeah.
I picked up two of the trades of that, and love the artwork in that. It reminds me of like Senkiewicz's painted stuff and everything like that. Okay. So
my son read that and loved it. He said it was really good.
Okay, nice. Cargo in the 60s with superheroes and bureaucracy and corruption and stuff.
I love that. Yeah. That's plenty for the.
I've just got a quick one.
Yeah, babe. Go for it.
Yeah, so Gods of Men, number 2. I got it through Kickstarter, came very quickly. Writer, Michael Phoenix. Art, Christian Paris. Colours, Simon Robbins. Letters, Rob Jones. So all people we know, all our pals.
Yeah.
If anyone's read issue 1, it starts off pretty violent in issue 1. There's this character called the Sentinel who's come down to Earth. And issue 1 ends with this sort of super team made up of Visage, Stryker, Maximus, Guardian and Doppler. They take him on, and there's just an unashamed bash him up pretty much for the whole issue, where lives are on the line. You know, it's sort of genuine tension that people might die and might not come back. Big stakes, big sort of building, shattering punches. It's almost like if Liefeld knew what he was doing. It's almost like if they did proper comics at the start of the Image Revolution, we'd have got Gods of Men. It's that sort of thing. Yeah. So go to michaelphoenix.co.uk at mphoenixuk on Twitter. I'm sure he's still got copies left. It's good fun. Yeah, really good. Very Mark Miller-esque, but not with that sort of homogenized Miller-esque sort of stuff. Mm. You know, where he's just trumping it out. This has got a real edge to it. Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah, I really like that one.
Yeah.
There you go. Nice. So plenty of awesome comics for you to read this week. No pun intended. So check out the show notes when you check out this episode, and we hope you enjoyed this episode. Yes. Be you writers, artists, or maybe you're just comic fans who'd like listen to us waffle on about nonsense. We hope you all got something from this show. If you had any questions, or maybe we pronounced something wrong, then there's several different ways you can get in touch with us about. You can email us awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @theawesomepod. Where I haven't been too active on the Twitter recently. I need to get back into it. It's probably, I've been busy in the 9-to-5 and these lads have been busy. Dan's been swanning off. Living his best life, haven't you, Dan?
Down at the Hello Kitty world. Yeah. Can't go wrong.
Yeah. There's going to be an autobiographical comic book about that in the future. but yeah, follow us on Twitter. If you do a Facebook, then go to facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast and like us there. And if you do like community groups or things like that, then join the group Awesome Comics Talk, because it's a fantastic community that's on there, and they're talking about comics, and there's lots of backwards and forwards, and people asking for advice about different things, or people to get involved. Lots of backwards.
There's loads of posts gone up today, actually. Yeah. It's going to be mad in the last few days.
Yeah, so there's lots of people. Maybe some people are... there was one... We're trying to keep away the hard sales and the Kickstarters and stuff. But if you have a Kickstarter that... not necessarily post a link, but if you want advice about like how should I do this or how should I do that, post on, because there's a lot of people on that group that have done this sort of stuff that will give you advice and stuff. So just to join Awesome Comics Talk. Thank you for listening to us.
I'd just like to say I think it's invaluable. You need to be on there, because if you're an indie comic maker, you know, that's where the talk is happening, and you can find out so much stuff from where the cons are to how to get it sorted and stuff like that. There's just loads of really great advice on that.
Thank you, man.
Cheers, dude.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know why we're saying it. We can't take any credit. It's the fantastic people on there that make it great. We just occasionally swan on to approve things or delete things.
I put some pictures of dildos on there today.
Excellent.
Right, I need to go on and delete that post. I'm going to cut you. I'm going to cut you from the administrators if you're going to play saucy.
Got a lot of likes. It got somebody who went, "What's all this? This can't be safe for work." And I'm thinking, "Have you listened to the podcast?"
I was about to say we'll be legit one day, but we never will. But thank you very much for listening to us week on week, folks. Or if you're new listeners, then go back there. We got tons of stuff back there that you can check out, whether it be on the website, awesomecomics.podbean.com. If you listen to us on iTunes, subscribe and leave a review. Thank you. We had a new review recently, didn't we?
Which really, yeah, nice one. Yeah, really yeah, nice one.
Yeah.
Thank, that really makes our day getting a review.
It does. Yeah, it really does. Yeah. Love it. Thank you for all the kind words about the show, and we hope you enjoy it. That's why we're doing it every week. And thank you for listening to us, whether it was on any of the networks. Doesn't necessarily have to be iTunes. It could be things like Spotify, Stitcher, Podnose, Podknife. What other networks are we on, Tony?
Pod Flaps. Cliff Cumber made me do that.
Well, I'm taking back that shout out because he doesn't deserve it now. Shout out rescinded, sir. Rescinded. But I really have to struggle not to laugh.
We've got into this like where you do sort of a grumpy silence after a second.
Yeah.
It's
love it.
Yeah. Yeah. But yes, yeah, so follow us on Twitter to find out more of this grumpy silence when it's not grumpy silence and we're grumpy about something else. Where can people find us online, etc., Tony?
Neveronanything.blogspot.co.uk and read my very saucy and salty commentary on a local convention that I went to. And there's a couple of reviews going up this next couple of days. So there you go.
Dan?
You can find me on Twitter at Vanguard Comic, and you can read Vanguard at vanguardcomic.com. If you want to see some of the work I'm putting together behind the scenes on Project Hoax and various other bits and bobs, go to patreon.com/vanguardcomic.
Nice.
Good stuff there, man. I'm loving that. Yeah, you're almost finished now. You must be almost done on it, aren't you?
I've got to do the last bits and bobs of the lettering, and that's the comic done. And then once the commissions are done, it's all done. Nice. I'm trying to end of August. It's going to be done.
Nice. So by the time that anyone listens to this in the far-flung future where humanity has been eradicated, Dan did it well within time.
Yeah. Maybe it's the foundation of a new society, that book.
Yeah, maybe.
That'd be scary.
God.
Or this podcast, even worse.
I know.
Like a society of degenerates.
Yeah. Speaking of degenerates, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Jester Diablo, and you can find out more about my comic at theredmaskfrommars.com. I've been working on some lots of artwork recently, but I can't show you all yet. But
looking good, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, you sent it through to me. Yeah, that's next level stuff for you, dude. I've got to tell you, I think that's really good.
Oh, thank you. Speaking of next level, Gareth.
Yeah.
Where can people find you, follow you, and generally just get your work online, etc.?
I'm probably most active on Twitter, so that's at Hesir, H-E-S-I-R. And from there, you'll find links to my art stash and Instagram and all the other stuff. So.
Yes, and you definitely need to be following it because, as with everyone on the show, he's gonna take off and he's gonna ignore us in the next couple of years, isn't he? he's driving that gold Lamborghini.
Days.
Yeah,
it'd just be useless. I don't drive it. It'd just be a giant paperweight.
You'd have someone to drive
it for you. Make noises. Yeah. What's that about?
Just sitting and go boop boop. No, thank you very much for joining us this week, Dodo. It was great.
No problem.
It was fantastic.
Great. Cheers.
And hope to see you at a show. Are you doing any conventions this year? What are you doing in terms of conventions?
Yeah, I'm doing a few more. I'm at Thought Bubble, obviously, sort of a big one every year we do. That's great. I'm at Brid in a few weeks, sort of like in early September. Yes. So Brid Comic come up there. So on the seaside, that'd be nice. I'm doing a weird one at the Lakes where it's more sort of like D&D oriented. So it's more towards the solace and the concept art stuff that I've done. So, but I'll still have some of my comics with me there. So I'll be there. So that, and obviously there's little bits and pieces coming out at the minute. Flintlock number 4's out. And I did a nice print, which was nice to be asked for Omar Dittar's Lad comic as well, which has just come out.
Yes.
Yes. So there you go. He's a busy man. So let's stop talking to him and let him get back to making comics. Thank you very much for listening, everyone.
Sorry, Vince.
Thank you very much for listening, everyone. From Dan, Tony, Gareth and myself. Have a brilliant week. Read loads of cool comics. Stay tuned next week when we move on to... What are we on to next week?
Colouring.
Colouring. We're going to be talking about the next stage. Well, is it the next stage? Well, it could be anything. But that's what we're talking about next week.
A stage.
Yeah, it's A Stage. So if you want to learn more about that, as well as the usual us being really childish, check us out next week. And from all of us here, have a brilliant week. And Dan Butcher, what do they do?
Stay awesome.
Brilliant. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
See ya.
See ya.
I was going to say flaps then. But
I know. I know. I'm glad you didn't.
That's right.
Because Dan smashes it with the sign off now.
Yeah, I don't want to do him down on that. I don't want to, you know, lower the energy by saying flaps.
It's the only thing I've got, man.
It's a big gun to bring out, though, my friend.
Dan, you've got so much more to give than that.
Yeah.
I'll spread my wings like an eagle and soar.